I have recently given up on three fights or battles, I guess, that I've been battling for a long time. Number one, yes, I saw the Technology Connections videos about dishwashers and dishwasher detergent. And I know that my dishwasher worked better on powder than on the dishwasher pods. I've been fighting this fight. I've been using dishwasher powder. And two things have made me start buying pods. Number one, we now have a dishwasher that was made after the pod era. The new dishwasher does not have the pre-rinse like cycle hole in it. It was designed for pods from the start.
Wait, what hole are you talking about? The pre-rinse thing is just a place that's not covered up that you put stuff in, right?
It's basically, I mean, so the one at the beach, it has like, you know, the big hole, and then there's like a smaller well next to it, but the flap covers both of them. But when you lift it up, like there's like little slots that like some of the powder and the pre-rinse will fall out when you close the door, like just from gravity.
You can just put the pre-rinse thing, like, you should send me a photo of your thing. I'll tell you where you should put it. But the point is, you want it to be someplace where when you close the door, it just falls down, because that's when it's going to be used.
I mean, why don't you just pour it in the bottom, then?
Yeah, you could do that. You could do that, too, but you're afraid of squirting it on the heating element or something, you know.
Now, I believe in that same video, I haven't watched it in a long time, but Alec just said, if just dump it on the door and then close the door, which is what we do.
Yeah, and the reason you don't do it in the bottom, like I said, is what if you're worried about a glob of it goes on the heating element and then, like, bakes on there or something?
Oh, yeah, I think, well, anyway, so reason number two that I'm just buying pods now is that it's getting harder and harder to find the powder. Like, I just have, like, a grocery store in the suburbs where I live here, and, like, the grocery store, that, you know, it's like a big chain grocery store, there's, like, one box left.
And you're gonna stop thinking like you're on Fire Island. You can buy things on the internet and they'll deliver them to your house. You know that? You don't have to get them in a wagon or anything.
I never thought about buying dishwasher powder on the internet. Like, it's so cheap.
You buy it in bulk. Like, it just, we don't use powder. We use, like, it's, like, essentially liquid or gel. It's, like, powder suspended in a thing, which I'm sure you can find. But if you want powder, just buy a couple boxes of it from Amazon and stick them in your basement.
Oh, that's interesting. I don't have a basement, but that's interesting. All right, okay. Maybe I might relent on this. Well, my other two fights, I think you might have more to say. I know Casey will about this next one.
Oh, no.
I have gone back to the official Dropbox client.
I never left, so, okay.
There's a better way, Marco. There's a better way, but carry on.
Wait, when you say the official one, file provider or no?
What's the current one from their website as of, you know, 3 days ago?
So that's the thing. I discovered this while doing a hyperspace development. I'm like, oh, I think I mentioned this ages ago in the show that, like, somehow I've managed to avoid upgrading Dropbox to the new version that uses Apple's file provider framework, the same underlying framework that powers iCloud Drive, because that's the new recommended way to do it. It's like, somehow Dropbox hasn't updated me. So when I was doing hyperspace development, I'm like, okay, I want to do the cloud storage support. I need to get the Dropbox version that supports file provider, but I wasn't going to put that on my computer. So I went to another computer. I'm like, all right, let me just make a new Dropbox account, download the client. I'm sure I'll have the file provider one. Not only did I not have the file provider version of the Dropbox client, but when I asked for it, it said, no, you can't have it.
Like, they wouldn't let you download it?
No, it's inside the app. You can say, like, do you want to use file provider or not? It said, this account is not eligible, because it was an account I had just created. This account is not eligible for the file provider version of Dropbox.
That's really weird.
So I think probably because you have an older account, you are eligible. But anyway, I think in settings somewhere it says, please use the file provider version, which is weird. You think it would be a different download or something. But anyway, my stance is that the file provider one is worse. So I hope you don't have it.
Thanks. I mean, we'll see. I mean, I've been using Maestral, this open source Dropbox client that uses, like, their API. And the reason why I switched to Maestral in the first place, we talked about it on the show, I think, years ago at this point.
Yeah, it was a long time ago.
Yeah, the reason why I switched is that the Dropbox app was getting really, like, just inefficient and bloated. And Maestral was just, like, it was, and this was right around the time that Dropbox switched to Electron for their app. Dropbox app took up tons of RAM. It was constantly idling CPU cores, like, you know, pegging CPU cores. It was just massively inefficient, and it was also adding a bunch of, like, annoyances, like, which it's still full of, you know, just, like, pestering you for more and more permissions, pestering you whenever you do anything on your computer that Dropbox might want a piece of. They'll pop up a modal in the middle of your work saying, hey, you know, you can use Dropbox for part of it, you know, like, just nagging the crap out of you. But And Maestral came up and was like, look, here's an open source thing. And it's, like, lightweight and very gentle on your resources and doesn't bug you at all. And I've used Maestral for years. The problem is it works, like, 98% of the time. And that other 2% drives me nuts. Like every time something doesn't sync from Dropbox, or it syncs really slowly, like, you know, I have to wait like 10 minutes for something to appear that like I know that I put there on a different computer or whatever. Like Maestro works really well a lot of the time, but not all of the time. And the actual official Dropbox client, I never had those problems with. Now, granted, I haven't used it in years. So maybe the new one, maybe the current Dropbox app is just as inconsistent, but probably not. It never was. It had a lot of other faults, but it always performed consistently in terms of like actually syncing your files quickly and reliably.
I still find that to be true, by the way, with the non-file provider version. Works all the time.
Great. I think when I gave up Dropbox's client for Maestro, I believe I was still on Intel Max, I think. What's different now is that we have all these efficiency cores, and macOS is designed for Apple Silicon. It's designed to put almost any background process on efficiency cores and to lock them there. They aren't even able to use the performance cores in most cases. So when Dropbox, if their client now has some kind of background process like pegging a CPU core, that's almost certainly going to spend its entire time running on an efficiency core. And the efficiency cores on Apple Silicon are basically free in terms of like, you know, what it does to your computing experience. Like you can have an efficiency core running 100% all the time. In fact, many system services do exactly that. And it's fine. Like nothing bad happens. You barely even notice any kind of power impact or heat or fan impact because the efficiency cores are really efficient. That's hence the name and why we keep getting a lot of them. So if an app like Dropbox starts spinning one of those cores now in on these modern Macs, it has almost no noticeable impact to the user or to the system performance. So anyway, I'm trying that for a while. I guess I'll report back if I have any major problems, but I have given up on the Dropbox fight. I am now back to the official Dropbox client. And finally, my third battle. This one I've been fighting for a while too. I think it started around the same time for similar reasons. I usually keep a few browsers installed on my computer. You know, I used to keep them all just because I was a web developer. I've pared down. Safari is my main browser. I used to also try to keep a second browser or third browser installed for not only sites that don't work in Safari, but also just like I like to have separate browsers to be able to test different account logins, a logged in versus not logged in state. One, like ever since I started the restaurant, I've been having a second browser for restaurant-related accounts to be logged into all the time, so it doesn't interfere with my main browser accounts. And so what I've used for this purpose, for a while I used Brave, which is one of those many browsers that's like, let's take Chrome and strip all the Google, you know, branding and certain integrations from it, but it's basically Chrome rebranded and kind of un-Googled. And Brave over time, it's been fine. It's gotten a little weird over time with like some of its own pushiness and weirdness. And it's like, I don't need you to be pushy. I'm using you to be specifically anti-pushy. So that's kind of weird. I've used Firefox for this purpose in recent years. If you haven't used Firefox in, you know, since its heyday a million years ago, give it a shot. It's actually very good in a number of ways. It's surprisingly fast and it's very good. However, a lot of stuff doesn't work in Firefox still, and that's probably never going to change given its market share. So there's a lot of now checking for Chrome specifically by websites and web apps. And some of this is just because they only want to test on Chrome because they're lazy or they're using some kind of cutting edge web API that is not well supported by other browsers. Some of it, though, is like they're just doing like dumb user agent checking. So because like, again, they don't want to bother checking for capabilities, which is bad in lots of ways. But that's the reality of the web these days. Some of it is like, you know, like I tried to pay my estimated taxes to a New York State website recently on another browser. And it's like, you have to use Safari or Chrome. We will not allow this. It's hard to not be using Safari and Chrome. I did try Orion. Because I've been using Kagi or Kaji, I think it's Kagi. I've been using Kagi as my search engine for a while. It's pretty good. Check it out.
Yeah, same.
It's actually very good. I mean to mention it on the show. I've had good luck with it. I've been using it for, I think, like 6 months. It's been great. Anyway, Kagi has a browser called Orion. It's very Safari-ish in certain ways, but it advertises a lot of like, you know, different features and compatibilities and everything. I have found Orion is promising for the future, but right now it's very beta. It crashes a lot. A lot of sites don't work on it. A lot of functionality doesn't work on it. And again, it's similar to like my Maestro thing with Dropbox. It's like maybe 98% of stuff works on it, but that last 2% is driving me nuts. and when my browser crashes like once a week, that's too much. Even though that's a small percentage of the time, but that's too much. So Orion, I've used for a while as this browser. I've now quit it. I have now just installed stupid Chrome. So now I have the actual Dropbox app and actual Chrome.
Well, for your things that you listed of why you had alternate browsers, have you tried Safari profiles?
No, I didn't, because one of the main reasons why is that I actually do want a Chrome-based browser installed, because over time it seems like Safari's compatibility with the web is actually getting worse. Like, I think it peaked, and then as Google has pushed a lot of like, you know, app-like native functionality to try to say, look, we're gonna tell you what we want to undermine the App Store and app hegemony. Like, we're gonna do what we want, and we're gonna call it a standard, and then people will say Apple's not following standards. Like, standards are such BS. It's always political. It's always what one company wants. Like, there's so much BS and marketing and pressuring behind quote standards, because like, who decides what's a standard? Like, it's always weird and pressuring like that.
W3C, Apple is a member as well. But the reasons you find sites that don't work in Safari has nothing to do with standards. It has everything to do with what you just said. Developers are only testing Chrome. Like, they're relying on some quirk or bug or legacy behavior that only exists in Chrome and is not compliant with any particular standard. Even if the standard says, like, this behavior is undefined, but Chrome behaves in a certain way, if you only test in Chrome, your site will only work in Chrome, because if you rely on that, undefined behavior. And so it's kind of...
That's
like,
true.
Safari has an uphill battle here because of their smaller market share. They have to figure out, why doesn't this site work in Safari? And what weird quirk of Chrome? Like, it's not like they're doing it nefariously. They're just like, well, we only test in Chrome because it's the only browser that matters. It drives me nuts too, but that's the reality.
Yeah, and also, like... you know, I know Safari is doing a lot of things now with privacy in mind to block certain behaviors or limit certain behaviors or filter certain, you know, sites or cookies or trackers or whatever. And that's great as my main browser when I'm just like reading the web. But that does mean stuff's going to break. I also like to use ad blocking extensions in Safari. But even when I disable those, when certain functionality breaks, a lot of websites seem to be breaking in Safari on certain functionality now. And I hadn't seen this for a long time. I hadn't seen this for a decade, but like just in the last year, I'm really seeing a lot of stuff break on Safari. And it's to the point now where it's like, my second browser should just be stupid Chrome, because I know, like, no matter what, if something doesn't work in Safari, I know I can go over to Chrome, not Brave, not Firefox, not Orion. If it's Chrome, I know it will work. So I'm back to stupid Chrome as my second browser. Still not my first. I really don't like it on a number of levels, but I'm certainly a Google skeptic in a lot of ways. So I like to keep some distance from Google, but here I am. I gave up.
Look at you, running official Dropbox, running Chrome as your second browser, so you'll be on an Intel Mac like me.
Yeah, I wouldn't hold your breath on that one.
All right, so I have some follow-up about this. First of all, do you have a Synology that you use anymore, or not really? Do you have one that you're using at this time, or no?
No, last Synology, I got that little 4-bay cheapo one, and it was a bad experience. Like, it was unreliable. It crashed and broke a lot, and needed to be rebooted all the time. And I was just like, you know, this is stupid. This is not. So right now, I have one of the new M4 Mac Minis. I got like the base model, just plus 10 gig Ethernet, and that's now my home file server and runs a few accessory tasks in the house.
As discussed on previous episodes, Casey.
Yeah, well, and that's why I thought that he didn't have a Synology anymore. But the reason I ask is I recently posted on my website about how you can excise Dropbox from your life if you do have a Synology in your world, but that's not applicable to you.
Well, and by the way, the reason I didn't do all that stuff, first of all, yeah, even when I had a Synology, I didn't do that because, like, to me, that is, it's adding so many potential points of failure. It's like, we can replace the Dropbox app with this Rube Goldberg machine over here. If you have this thing and this, you install this thing on it, and this other package, you know, connects this to this, and it's like, I could do that. I'm glad you do it. I'm glad it works for you most of the time.
No, but all the time. It always works.
Occasionally, Marco will say, "Hey, where's your file?"
Yeah, that's because I'm an idiot and forget to upload it. That has nothing to, or forget to put it in the right folder. That has nothing to do with the Dropbox Rube Goldberg machine.
All right, that's okay, fair. But yeah, maybe I blame your Rube Goldberg box for, you know, too much. But anyway, more complexity is not what I'm going for. To me, it's like, all right.
And that's also fair. Yeah. I just, the last time I used the Dropbox app, it was such a pile of trash. Now, admittedly, this was years ago, and it was such a pile of trash that I could not stand it anymore. And it was turning into Electron, where it was like, hey, have we told you about Work Chat or whatever, Evernote. It was turning into Evernote, where it was constantly like pimping other things that it wanted you to use. And oh God, I just hated every moment of it. If it works for you, that's fine. It does not work for me anymore.
I mean, so what I'm hoping, like, because you're right, like, it is like growth hacked out the butt. It is so annoying. Like Dropbox, it's one of those, they're just shamelessly just shoving crap in your face all the time. Whenever you open up the window on your Mac, or if you go to, God forbid, the Dropbox website, it just shoves crap and promos and hooks at you for just, hey, give us more. Hey, do more with us. Give us more. Upgrade. It's like all, and I pay for it. So what I need Dropbox to be is, I'm going to give you some money every year and you're going to sync my files. And that's it. That's all I want. That's what the money's for. So
it's a reference, Casey.
But yeah, but I'm hoping that by having installed the app and having paid them the money, if I never actually need to open the Dropbox window and I never have to actually open the Dropbox website, I'm hoping this will work the way I need it to, which is, I gave you the money, you sync my files, and you don't bother me. We'll see.
I mean, that's fair. And again, like, it does not, that is not something I want in my life, and I'm willing to trade some complexity to not have to deal with that. Your perspective is totally reasonable, and in fact, probably the smarter one, if I'm honest with myself. The other piece of follow-up, just to get ahead of the 8,000 emails we are going to get, have you tried the Arc browser? Do you want to try the Arc browser? And if you did, why aren't you using it? I have tried it, although admittedly not recently. It wasn't for me. It was too different. And I didn't think that it was doing things that I wanted in my life. But the Arc people are going to come for you if you don't at least acknowledge the existence of Arc.
I think Opera's better.
I can't tell if you're messing with me or not.
No, does Opera still exist?
It does.
I use that joke so many times. Yeah, the Opera person is going to get really mad at me. Arc, I've heard of Arc. I haven't checked it out, because what everyone says is a version of what you just said, which is like, this is a really interesting idea. It's like when all the reviews came out of the Palm Pre, you know, but it's going back a ways, but like all the reviews of the Palm Pre were like, this is really interesting. And no one used it. Like, no one bought it. No one said, I'm personally switching to the Palm Pre. You know, maybe Christina Warren might have, but like, oh, no one else did. And so like, there's a lot of things come out in tech where it's like, this is interesting. This is a new, fresh take on something. And the reviews are all like, yeah, this is interesting. I've done it. Like, this is an interesting new way to do something. But when it comes to like actually real life use, like, oh, actually, no, I want the normal way, please. Like, this is, it's too weird, or it has too many downsides or quirks or edge cases. And there's a reason the normal way is the normal way. And so,
wasn't the Palm Pre the one that WebOS first launched on?
Yes.
What the Palm Pre put out in many ways became the normal way. I think the reason people didn't use the Palm Pre is the combination of ingredients did not make for a satisfying meal, to torture that analogy a little bit. But many of the software and interface innovations on the Palm Pre eventually became the normal ways that phones work. So I think those kind of articles make a lot of sense. So there's a lot of good ideas here. But in the end, does this coalesce into a product that I think, you know, was going to replace whatever my current phone was? And that didn't work out for Palm, but their ideas were good there.
Yes, but it was like, you know, similar to like using a third-party browser. It's like, well, there's a whole ecosystem around this. So with Palm, you know, one of the problems was the Palm Pre, you know, it had a bunch of good ideas, but it was like, is it better than the iPhone? And I think BlackBerry was still big at the time. Like, is it better than the iPhone and BlackBerry? No. Like, oh, there's some good ideas. Everyone's like, well, I hope the iPhone takes some of these ideas. And over time it did. But no one was like, these ideas are so good that I'm willing to forego the other, like, you know, the ecosystem, the inertia, the developer support. So, you know, see also like Windows Phone 8. Windows Phone 8 had a bunch of interesting ideas, some of which were pretty good. But that also got a bunch of the same reviews of like, this is really interesting. There's some really good ideas here. But, you know, you check with those reviewers, like, did you actually buy a Windows 8 phone and use it full time? Oh, no, of course not.
Yeah, well, the arc equivalent of that is there may be good ideas in Arc, but in the end, if what you want is a browser that you know the sites will work in, that's where you end up at the browser that has the most market share, which back in the day was IE, so how do you feel about that? But today is Chrome.
There are only so many battles I'm willing to fight at once. And like when you go off the beaten path, when you say I'm not going to use the biggest choice or the most popular choice or the official app for something, you're oftentimes signing up for some degree of friction by doing that. You're saying, well, yes, it's not going to quite work all the same way, or certain things might be worse in order for me to get the better behavior I'm looking for with another alternative or whatever. Like, there's always trade-offs and friction involved in that. That might be worth it for you in certain ways. Like, I do certain things the hard way, the weird way, or the off-the-beaten-path way, but I can't do everything that way. So I will have the areas that I care a lot about, like tweaking and having special certain ways, and I'm willing to tolerate the shortcomings or the missing features or the occasional friction that comes from those things. But the web browser, I just got tired of maintaining that battle. You know, I just want a web browser that loads web pages and they work reliably.
Man, that Dropbox thing is killing me. You know what has also been killing me is not having a limited time merch sale going on. But guess what, baby?
Smooth transition.
Thank you. It is merch time. So, John, why don't you take us on a tour of the storefront and let us know what's available, please?
This is our annual WWDC sale, which we usually do around the same time. We used to try to get these on sale so that they could be manufactured and delivered to you so you could wear them to WWDC where you'd see all the other nerds. But now so few people get to go to WWDC that it's not really a factor. But we still want it to be early enough that if on the off chance that you did want to wear one of these WWDC, there is a chance that you could order it, receive it, and then wear it to California. Anyway, this is the crop of products we have for you this year. So to start, we have two new M-Series shirts. It occurred to me when I was making these that we never actually did a shirt for the M2 Ultra. I don't know if it was just not exciting enough or it fell when it was introduced, fell between sales, and by the time we had a sale, it seemed like it was old news. But you know what's not old news? The M3 Ultra. That's very recent news, and we've got an M3 Ultra shirt.
It sounds like old news.
Yeah, it does, but that's part of the excitement. We have an M3 Ultra shirt now. If you wear an M3 Ultra shirt, people might wonder, is he wearing that ironically? And like, maybe you are, but maybe you're not, because it is Apple's most powerful chip. Like, there's no one that's better than it, but the number is lower than the other chips, and the M4 Max does beat it in a lot of things, including single thread, but not even in other situations, the M4 Max comes real close. But anyway, it is the biggest and baddest chip. So we have an M3 Ultra shirt for you. Again, no chip design in the back, just a regular M3 Ultra. And we also have, I have to fix the image on our website. I know it's wrong. I'll fix it after the show. Anyway, we also have, in the tradition of the M1 Ultra, which is the only other Ultra shirt that we did, we have the M3 shirt, where instead of saying M3 with Ultra underneath it, it recognizes the fact that the M3 Ultra, like the M1 Ultra, is made of two Max chips stuck together with the silicon interposer thing, right? And last time we did that, we had, like, instead of Ultra, it said Max, and then it had rotated, 180 degrees or whatever, Max stuck end-to-end to it, so the other Max is upside down. But this time it doesn't say Max, because the M3 Ultra isn't really two M3 Maxes stuck together. It's two M3 Max-ish chips stuck together, because they have Thunderbolt 5, and who knows what other changes. They have the interposer, and the actual M3 Max doesn't have one, So I see it. I can't do it. What was that? I already forgot the thing. The die-to-die interconnect, D2D. Anyway, sorry, nomenclature experts. It's impossible for me not to say interposer. In fact, the name of this product is M3 Ultra Interposer. So anyway, this is the joke M3 shirt. It says M3 Max ? And then flipped over Max ? Anyway, you'll see the design. It's basically the same joke as we did with the M1 Ultra, only now with a question mark, because it is two things stuck together, neither of which was ever sold individually. So there you go. Because this is WWDC and because I'm me, we are offering the Mac Pro Believe shirt again. This is the shirt we offered, I think like 2 years ago, when we were hoping for the Mac Pro to come back. And it came back and had an M2 Ultra in it. It was just a gigantic Mac Studio with slots. What's going to happen this year? Probably a giant Mac Studio with slots that has an M3 Ultra in it that costs $7,000 or whatever. Like, that'll be sad. Which means we have to keep wearing the shirt
John still believes.
I'm going to keep pushing this shirt. If I were going to WWC, which I almost certainly am not, because of conflicts with my daughter's senior prom and her graduation, I would wear this shirt. When I went to WWC last year, I wore this shirt. It didn't work last year, but maybe we just need more people to wear the shirt. So if you bought this shirt already, please wear it to WWC. And if you would like to buy one of these shirts, we have it available. It's also available in long sleeve, sweatshirt, most of our things are now available in like every possible thing. So if you don't want a t-shirt, but you want a long sleeve t-shirt or a crew neck sweatshirt or a tank top, most of these products are available in all those things. So we've got the Mac Pro Believe shirt with a light and dark ink with a bunch of different colors. Our returning product, because we usually like to bring like old products back from the Disney vault, so to speak. We've got the Pro Max Triumph shirt, which I think is one of our better looking shirts for people who have no idea what the shirt is about, because it's just a bunch of like solid shapes in the Apple six colors and then accidental tech podcast underneath it. So people who have no idea what it is, they can just read the words and go, oh, it's about a podcast, I guess. Good job. And if they don't know what all those shapes are on the top of it, it just looks like a nice design. From a distance, it might seem like, oh, you have a bunch of colors. But in fact, those are the silhouettes of a bunch of Apple's most powerful Macs, starting with the original Mac, or maybe it's the SE30. It's whatever you want it to be. The Mac 2, the G3 blue and white tower, the original cheese grater, the trash can, and today's Mac Pro. So those two shirts coming back. We got that in white and black. We've got our performance shirt back, which is the shirt that you sweat in. We introduced a couple new colors for that last time. What is this made out of? It's like, Casey, you're the sweaty shirt expert.
It's like Under Armour is like the standard issue trade brand for this. It's the Kleenex of this category. But the idea is, if you get the shirt wet, if you're like sweaty or whatever, you can still pull it off of you, unlike a regular cotton t-shirt where it's like welded to your skin. This will actually come off of you. And I wear one of these shirts pretty much every afternoon when I work out. So I really genuinely like these shirts a lot.
It's workout season, so we've got our performance shirt. And then, of course, we've got our regular ATP logo monochrome shirt. Listen to our member special episode about our logo to learn the difference between our monochrome logo and our color logo. They are different. And then, of course, we have our classic ATP shirt with the six-color ATP logo on it, also available in long sleeve, sweatshirt, blah, blah, blah. Some news about the hoodie, our beloved hoodie. So many of these hoodies have been purchased, including by my own family. Unfortunately, the hoodie that we've been selling for years and years is no longer made. So that's a bummer. But the same company offers a slightly different model of hoodie, and that's what we're selling. The differences are that the drawstring is no longer flat. Like if you've got one of these hoodies, you know, like the drawstring was kind of like a flat, like a big shoelace kind of thing, which I liked, but is unusual. The new one has a drawstring that is more rounded, more like a, I don't know, like a normal hoodie drawstring. And there's no longer rayon in the fabric. We'll try to put links in the show notes to the old model and the new model so you can compare if you care. They look very similar. But just be aware that if you have the existing hoodies, it's no longer manufactured. Nothing we can do about it. We've got the ATP polo, again, short sleeve, warm weather. It's our fanciest piece of clothing that we have. And the last time we sold this, we introduced a couple of new colors, and those are available. We've still got ATP mugs. We're still trying to sell through the mugs that we just ordered too much of last time. Hopefully we'll drain the remainder of the inventory. If you want a mug, you should order them soon-ish because there aren't a lot of them. But it could be that we just keep selling these mugs forever because we bought too many. So we'll see how that goes. These are the white mugs with the cobalt, they call it, cobalt-colored logo and inside. I think they look great. Maybe the world doesn't agree. If we ever sell through these mugs, we may sell mugs in a different color, or we may take a long break from mugs because maybe people just don't want mugs anymore. Anyway, that's there. And finally, we've got the ATP hat with the embroidered ATP logo on it, available in a couple of different colors. So there you go. That's the ATP WWC store for this year. Even if you're not going to WWC, check it out. Of course, if you are an ATP member, you get 15% off everything in the store. How do you do that? You go to your member page at atp.fm. There will be a discount code for you. Copy and paste it into the checkout process. If you are a member and you're logged in when you go to atp.fm/store, we will try to autofill that discount code for you. But if the autofilling thing doesn't work, just copy and paste it from your member page. This sale ends Sunday, April 27th. So as usual, we'll have three episodes of the show to promote the sale. But just mark that date in your calendar before Casey starts nagging you about forgetting about it. That will definitely happen.
Oh, absolutely.
I think that covers it. Am I forgetting anything?
I think the challenge with mugs is that it's not that nobody likes the mugs. It's that you buy a mug and then it lasts a very long time. But
people
then
break them. We see the sad people breaking it all the time and they say, hey, I just broke my mug, can I get another one? And they got like one of the ones with the rainbow logo, and like, we haven't sold those in years. It's like, no, you should buy two, they break.
But well, that's the challenge, is like the demand for a mug. It's like you have a big spike when everyone buys their mugs, then you have nothing. It's like, it's like people who buy iPads. It's like, I bought an iPad, now it's fine, and it's going to be fine for like 7 years at least. And so like eventually, you know, you break your mug, but that we haven't sold them because there was no demand in the meantime. But when you break your mug, you have very high demand at that moment. Like, no one ever says, I dropped my hoodie, oh my God, I urgently need a new one. You know, but the mugs, that happens.
Yeah, I have some different product ideas for the mug. Because we sold a couple of different varieties of them, and there are some interesting ideas of how we might mix it up a little bit and make them more interesting. But none of that is happening until we sell through the mugs that we already paid for. So,
yeah.
Sorry, but I really like this mug, though. I might buy more of them because I break mugs, too. These mugs are actually very popular in our house, but we've still got them in stock. So if you want them, come get them.
All right, let's do some follow-up. I promise I'll make this super quick. I wanted to bring back Vision Pro Corner. It will not be every week, despite what it seems, but there's a little bit more news. First of all, a friend of mine pointed out to me the Voices of VR podcast, episode 1,557. I have no idea how it's that high, but I guess they've been going forever.
Do they do two at once, like simultaneously?
I don't know. I have no idea. But this was an interview with Ant something or other, who was the star of the Apple Immersive video, the Adventure Immersive video on ice diving or ice swimming or whatever. This was a little less than an hour, and I found it fascinating because the star of the video takes you through, like, when did he know it was for the Vision Pro? When was this recorded? How did they record it to the degree that someone who is not a film professional understands and knows how to talk about such things? For me, it was absolutely worth my time. I thought it was a great episode of a podcast that I don't typically listen to. So it's worth checking out. I'll put a link in the show notes. Additionally, there's a new series on Apple, you know, Vision Pro on Apple TV Plus or whatever. I don't even know how they classify it. But suffice to say, you know, there's Adventure. There's, I forget what the other ones are called, but I'm drawing a blank now. But Nature, I think, is one of them. But there's a new one called VIP. And this is where they're, I guess, going to take you through sports stadiums. And so there's a 10 to 15 minute, I think it's like 13 minute video on Yankee Stadium. I'm not much of a baseball person, but again, really cool stuff. It is a content snack, which I know is what Marco was about to say, and he's right, but it's cool. And if you have one, it's worth your time. There, see, quick and easy. We got some feedback on feedback. Matthew Fenslow writes, the HB crew has often complained about the lack of communication from Apple when they file a bug report feedback. On the other hand, you guys correctly point out that as indie developers, you can't possibly reply to individual bug reports, but that you find the reports useful in aggregate to guide software improvement. iOS has like 1.5 billion users. Apple employs a total of 164,000 people. Even if 1% of Apple employees worked in iOS support, which would be a crazy amount, the customer support employee ratio would be 1,000,000 to 1. I have to assume if you guys had 1 million paying users, would have just bought John a non-Honda car for fun by now. Yes, I would have bought John a non-Honda car, and he would refuse to drive it, even if it was a Ferrari. This is just one of the many Apple software products. At that scale, it seems amazing to me that Apple responds to any bug reports from individuals rather than just taking a statistical approach. I would think just screening out the people who file bugs that their iPhone is haunted or controlled by aliens is a Herculean effort. I never can get that out right. Anyways, to me, the obvious conclusion is that filing bug reports is useful because if Apple gets 100 or 1,000 similar reports, it may result in a fix. But the expectation that you would ever hear back is just not realistic. Before I move on, John, any thoughts about that?
Yeah, this is kind of like the Fermi paradox type of thing for feedback, in that I'm not so sure about your assumptions there before you start doing the math. Yeah, there are like 1.5 billion iOS users. But to clarify, and this is one of the reasons I put this in here, when we're talking about this, we're not talking about feedback from customers. Maybe that's like not clear in our discussions. We're talking about feedback from developers. Apple does have mechanisms for feedback from customers. It's a different mechanism than the one we use as developers. It's like a form on the web page. You got anything to say about Apple stuff, you can put it there. I don't know how they handle that. But what we're talking about is essentially developer support. You are a developer, in most cases, I would imagine, a paying developer. There are way fewer than 1.5 billion of those.
Oh, gosh.
There's like there's millions, but not 1.5 billion. So suddenly your math is not as bad as it seems here. And the second thing is, of all the developers that you have, like those millions of developer accounts, how many of them are filing bugs? Now your ratio gets even lower. That's why we're saying that with the amount of money that Apple has and the amount of employees or whatever, we have higher expectations for responsiveness. It doesn't mean that they're going to have personal support for every single thing, but just sort of the basics we expect of automated systems, where like when you do anything having to do customer support with like your cable company or whatever, like that you get a response and you get a ticket number and you can see it, your support request being processed through the system, and you know, things happen. That simple thing of like getting a number or whatever. Now, you do get a ticket thing if you like email the developer technical support or whatever, but Apple's feedback system for developers is not like that. So I question the math here. And again, the assumption that I think is missing in this is that we're not talking about random feedback from 1.5 billion developers. We're talking about a very much smaller group of people who already pay Apple money. And as for 1% of Apple employees working in support, which would be a crazy amount, I don't think that's a crazy amount. If 1% of the company is doing support, I wonder if that if they already have more than 1% of the employees doing support. If you count Apple retail employees, they almost certainly do. So anyway, math here I think is off, but I just wanted to clarify, it's not any random feedback from any Apple customer. It is feedback from usually paying Apple developers.
Anonymous writes, I wanted to push back a bit on the assertion that if you were making enough money to support yourself as an indie, you would get so much email that you wouldn't be able to answer at all. The economics of games are probably different from utility apps, but I'm an indie developer making puzzle games. My apps are free to play, not scammy, and comfortably support a family of four. I answer every email I get because I typically only get one per day, and most of them are answerable with stock responses. I think John probably, and I don't mean this to be dismissive, probably has the least users of any of us. I think I am in the middle, and I think Marco is far and away more users than John or I probably combined. And I got to tell you, I feel like I get at least a handful of emails a day. And on a busy day, I may get as many as 10. So yeah, I mean, I'm not saying this anonymous person's experience isn't what they claim it to be, but I feel like I get more email than they do.
Games are very different, I feel like. Like, sort of the lower stakes apps where people either, like, it's not something they're using for their work, and so if something goes wrong, it's, like, pressing, or it's not complicated. Like, games are for fun. And I'm not saying games don't get support. Depending on the type of game you may get a lot of support. But they're a genre of application where if you make a good self-contained game without like this complicated network component or any other part, like it's true of any app. The app you make does in some ways dictate the support load that you get. So it's another things that was missed in our past conversation of this is like, well, what kind of thing are you making and how does that influence your support burden? And I would imagine if you make a self-contained, non-server-based, non-multiplayer game with no user-uploaded content, like if you make like a solitaire game or something, once your bugs are all worked out and you have a fairly obvious user interface, I bet your support load really is low. But if you're making something much more complicated, like say a podcast client that has to read arbitrary podcast feeds and people who are upset when their podcast doesn't download and so on and so forth, maybe your support load is higher.
Yeah, I mean, it varies. Like support inquiries per user per day is not fixed between different app types or different apps even. So it depends a lot what your app is doing. This is part of why, for instance, like, you know, tools that work in like specialized environments for professionals, any kind of, you know, production tool or specialized business tool, their ratio of like how much support is needed per customer tends to be way higher than consumer stuff that we all make. And you know, and then of course within consumer apps you have all these different categories, as John was just saying. So like, I can tell you, like, I get like on a slow day I might get 15 support emails. On a busier day it might be, you know, well more than that. Certainly after the rewrite launched last summer I was getting over 100 a day. And the thing is, and by the way, it isn't just email. If you also, you know, people expect support everywhere and they expect people to post in public. And so like there's Twitter or X, whatever, there's Mastodon. There is, you know, if you create an account on like Blue Sky or Threads, anywhere that you try to create a presence, people will use that as a support channel. If you have any kind of, you know, forum or Discord or Slack, Reddit, and Reddit, by the way, Reddit, like, they'll create one for you whether you're there or not.
Yep.
So there's all these different channels you have to then add. And so suppose you have, you know, a few things trickling in every day from all the different channels, plus your 15 to, you know, 30 to 40 to 50 whatever emails. In one good work day, maybe you can get through all those. Now, keep in mind, that isn't 15 emails saying you're great or you suck. Some of them are that way, and those are easy. You read them, you delete them, you move on with your life. Maybe, you know, maybe you, if you want to send like a canned, you know, text expander kind of shortcut kind of response to, you know, to some of them, depending on what they are, fine. But they aren't all that simple. A lot of them are feature requests. So then you got to, okay, well, now you got to like maybe catalog that or note that down somewhere or add a vote somewhere to a tally if you're keeping some kind of system like that. Maybe they're actually reporting specific problems and specific bugs that you haven't seen before. You got to log that in. That takes time. Maybe you have to try to work with them to troubleshoot things or walk them through something. Maybe it's an inquiry about some kind of business thing, like wanting to buy ads, you know, in my case, or, you know, I need some help with my podcast being listed improperly in Overcast or whatever. Every one of those takes a different amount of time. And some of them, again, some of them are real quick. Some of them are really not. Some of them can take away hours from your day because all of a sudden you discover, oh, this one, you know, image that this person used for their podcast artwork is breaking the resizing thing because it uses some weird JPEG tag or, you know, like there's all these different things like that can happen with whatever your app is. Or somebody has like an odd behavior on their user account. You got to try to figure out why is this happening to them? And that's on a good work day. So suppose that number for you is, you know, 30 emails a day or 30 inquiries or whatever per day. But the way that works, though, is those come in every day. You aren't working every day. There are weekends. There are holidays. Maybe you're sick. Maybe you're working on the app and you're not reading email all day. The problem is they accumulate. And so you might think, oh, yeah, in a good day, I can get through 30 emails. Okay, great. But every day, those are going to start building up. And then you can't give that amount of attention to all of them. Like once you cross a threshold of, you know, whatever you can handle being a daily or accumulating thing, once you cross that threshold, it starts piling and you fall behind. And then what do? You have to start not responding to everything or giving things canned responses, which I hate. So I try to avoid doing that. But support is a very, very difficult burden to do over time because it just never ends. You never get a weekend from support. You never get a spring break from support. It never stops. So what sounds like a small amount, it can quickly accumulate when life gets in the way.
Yeah, it's just I do hear the argument about scale for Apple and scale even for us, but I don't know. I mean, it's just I feel like the amount of time it would take me to provide the support that I wish I could provide is astronomically more than I am capable or willing to give to that task. And similarly, the amount of money it would take to solve this problem with money by paying somebody else to do it is astronomically more than I can afford for this task. So I get what these people are saying, but mm-mm.
And by the way, and on that front, by the way, like the like just pay someone else to do it idea. One of the challenges that is like everything I just mentioned about like things that can take time and respond to an emails. How many of those can somebody else do? Like if you are the programmer, if you're the only programmer on the app, which most indies are, you have to be the one to address most of those things. So you know, if you had a support person filtering through emails and maybe just escalating things to you that needed your attention, like that helps. You could argue that might be, you know, doable by an AI these days. But you know, that it helps to have that, but you're still getting enough stuff kicked up to you every single day that like, you know, the support person can't do that much. If a problem somebody reports is non-obvious, you know, they can maybe help somebody reset their password or something. But like, if it's something like, hey, there's a bug with this artwork, as I said, or like my user account is behaving weirdly because of some entry in it, like, that's probably going to get kicked to you no matter what. So having any kind of filtering or person in front of you, it helps in some ways, but it doesn't really help the overwhelming buildup over time by an indie.
Vitor writes, it seems that someone inside Apple is feeling the bug reporting criticism. I just noticed this in my feedback assistant inbox, and we'll put a link to the post or whatever it was in the show notes, but there are two images. One reads, updates released. Thank you for your participation. The final versions of these updates are now publicly posted and available through Software Update. And then a different image. We appreciate your participation. You have helped contribute to the overall quality of our products. And many issues have been addressed as a result of your efforts. We realize that testing may have involved a great deal of time on your part to provide feedback, submit follow-up information, and reinstall software along with your daily work. Thank you for your dedication. That's nice.
Yeah, this is actually just one big image. It was saying like, hey, new versions of the OSs are out. I'm just trying to trim out that part. But like,
oh, my bad.
Part of addressing this gap between what developers want out of processing feedback from Apple and what Apple does is, in fact, what we're seeing here. You may look at this and saying like, oh, Apple can say all they want, but their words don't mean anything and I'm still angry and blah, blah, blah. But this little passage here at the bottom of like, oh, here's the new betas, by the way, this little paragraph of saying like, we understand that it is work for you to do these things. Thank you. That is actually part of the solution. It sounds like it's not. It sounds like, I wish they wouldn't say these nice things. I wish they would just do it. But saying this, acknowledging it, communicating in a more human way with developers actually is an essential part of a solution to this problem. It's not the solution to this problem. You have to do things. You have to actually do stuff as well. But I'm not going to turn up my nose at this. I'm going to say,
I agree.
That's a good step. And for Apple to like acknowledge that we exist and that providing this feedback is work, and maybe even like with a little detail of like, oh, you got to reinstall the software and it's annoying, and you got to like acknowledging how difficult it is for us to navigate their system or whatever, is just one tiny baby step towards, you know, an actual sort of, I don't know, like a more upfront acknowledgement of the problems. And then maybe even imagine this, solving the problem. So I am not feeling cynical today about this, and I want to congratulate whoever at Apple somehow snuck through this somewhat human paragraph of text to the developers.
Yeah, it again, as John said, it's not solving the entire problem, but it helps. You know, the challenge that Apple has with feedback and developers is that we feel like we are unappreciated and that they are wasting our time and they don't listen to us or they don't respect the time we put into things.
And there's no other, like, there's no person we can connect with because Apple like hides the people and just provides this sort of like impersonal face to everybody. And that is not satisfying.
Yeah. And so if they're showing signs of like, okay, you know what? We actually care about you. Actions speak louder than words, but words help. A little bit, you know, like just the actions will speak louder.
They're an essential part because we want them to acknowledge the reality that we see before us. Like with them sort of just stonewalling and just putting a happy face on everything, it just makes us angrier. You know what I mean? Like you feel even more ignored. So this is actually an essential part of sort of healing this divide.
Yeah. Well, and let's see the actions next, but this is a good start. We are brought to you this episode by Squarespace, the all-in-one website platform for entrepreneurs like you to stand out and succeed online. Whether you're just starting out or managing a growing brand, Squarespace makes it easier for you to create a beautiful website for you and your business. You can engage with your audience and sell anything from products to content to time, all in one place and all on your terms. Squarespace makes it super easy to make your business's website, no matter what your business is. So they have all this amazing support, and I've seen it myself because my wife actually runs a Squarespace business site for a storefront she runs. And I've seen, first of all, I don't have to help at all. I never have, and I don't need to because it's not just for nerds. Like anybody can go to Squarespace and make everything. You don't have to be a nerd to understand or run it. It's great. So everyone's empowered to do this without having to go find somebody like me to like, you know, code stuff or do stuff for them, which is great. And all the business support is there. So whether you're selling digital goods, physical goods, you can have like member content, member areas, newsletters, private podcasts. You can even book sessions if you're like a coach or a trainer or something. There's so much you can do with Squarespace. It's all backed by their amazing easy design system. They now have amazing AI functionality called Design Intelligence. So this allows you to build a beautiful personalized website tailored to your needs, and it lets you craft your own digital identity that you can use across your entire online presence. All this is supported by amazing payments and systems behind all that, so your business works well, your customers can pay however they want, even, you know, less commonly supported methods, let's say. Things like, you know, Klarna, direct debit, Apple Pay, of course, Afterpay, ClearPay. Whatever you want, it's supported. See for yourself at squarespace.com. You can start a free trial. You can build the site, see how it works for you. When you're ready to launch, go to squarespace.com/ATP for 10% off your first purchase of a website or a domain. So once again, squarespace.com/ATP. Start that free trial, and when you go to that link, you'll save 10% when you're ready to purchase. Thank you so much to Squarespace for sponsoring our show.
Apple's big OS redesign. Mark Gurman has said that Solarium is the code name for the iOS 19 and macOS 16 redesigns, which explains a lot about what's to come. John, you seem to have done some research on solariums on behalf of all of us. Tell me about them.
I don't know if everyone knows what a solarium is. So I was just, I was going to put a definition here. It's just like a sunroom. If you know what a sunroom is, if you're in the US, the definition that I got off the web was a room fitted with extensive areas of glass to admit sunlight. It's a sunroom.
If you're on Long Island, by the way, houses seem to come with these and they are all illegal. Like literally every house that we saw contained an illegally built, like without a building permit kind of sunroom.
Mm-hmm.
Every single one.
It's a thing. Anyway, there's a second definition, which I thought was fun, which is a room equipped with sun lamps or tanning beds that can be used to acquire an artificial suntan. I'm hoping that's not the definition that Apple was going with for their code name, but rather they were going with the room filled with glass, which makes some kind of sense. So there you go. A code name that backs up the discussions of the new look.
Well, there you go. And then we have a video from Front Page Tech, which does a bunch of really impressive looking mock-ups of how they believe iOS 19 to look based on, I guess their team has seen or used builds of iOS 19, and then they re-implement what they've seen in order to protect, you know, their sources and whatnot. It's very well done. I mean, it's not 100% pixel for pixel perfect, but it's darn good.
Yeah, this video was kind of a clapback, as the kids say, to Mark Gurman saying, oh, John Prosser and Front Page Tech, they don't know anything. What they video they show, that's not actually what it looks like. And so Front Page Tech was like, oh yeah, well actually we've seen a new build and we've seen more parts of the OS and here it is. And the whole Front Page Tech thing, which I think is actually fairly clever, is don't show like your inside information that you have. Look at what either someone has shown you or screenshots they sent you or something you've seen on a dev build on your own device or whatever, which by the way, you probably shouldn't admit that you have. But anyway, don't actually show that. Instead, look at it and then have artists essentially recreate it, kind of like a courtroom sketch or something where you can't have cameras in the courtroom. So that's what they've done. So everything in this video is not the real iOS 19. It is an artist's reproduction of a build, supposedly a build of iOS 19 they have. And this video has way more than the old one, because the old one was like, here's the new camera app with the glassy stuff and everything. We talked about it a while ago. This shows more of the OS, and it has a couple of interesting tidbits. So first is the little, the glassy like things they were showing in the camera app. This shows them in more places. For example, on the lock screen, when you've got the little flashlight thing and the camera button, those are kind of like glassy with a supposed shimmer that moves around the edges, kind of like the old, I still don't know if iOS currently does this. Remember the old parallax thing where you tilt your phone and the desktop background would shift to try to make it look like it's like embedded in the screen? Well, this has a shine that moves around the rim of the round buttons on the lock screen to make them look shiny. So they look shiny and glassy with like a beveled edge or something. But the real important thing here is, you'll see in the video if you watch the whole thing, talking about, oh, everyone, when we said it was going to look like VisionOS, everyone said, you mean it's going to have round icons? We discussed that on the show when we discussed that original video. And they said, well, the build we saw back then didn't have rounded icons, so we didn't say that it did. But apparently this current build that they're using has not circular icons, but icons where the corner radius is increased over what it currently is. And to be clear, the current icons are not squares with quarter circles stuck on the edges. They're squircles, which is a more complicated mathematical shape that blends the curve more seamlessly into the flat parts. Anyway, in their video, they show icons that are basically more rounded but still not circular, which is like, why? All right, again, we don't know if this is true. We don't know if this is just a dev build with a thing that isn't going to ship. We don't know anything about this, but please watch the video if you would like to see how would iOS look if the corners on the icons had maybe a radius that was like twice as round, so they're almost circles but not quite.
Answer: bad.
Think about how that would affect every icon that was not made by Apple and had a year's notice about this. How do you feel about more of the corners of your icon being cut off?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if this is going to ship, but I'm just like, I look at this and I just shake my head and it's like, this, okay. Like I'm almost at the point where I'm like, you know what? At least round icons would be a big fresh change and there would be this big dividing line. Remember before iOS had round icons and after, right? But this is like not doing either. It's, let's cause immense disruption, but still not be distinct enough that most people will even notice, but it will just drive developers up a wall as they have to redesign all their icons to handle a little bit more of the corners being cut off.
There's a couple things here, you know, to note. First of all, yes, this is a rumor. and a mock-up, you know, so it's like, you know, game of telephone based on probably already kind of sketchy and probably unreliable information to begin with.
In builds of the OS where this feature is not prominent and maybe was hidden on purpose, or maybe was hidden because it's not a thing that they're doing. Like, if people don't know, in dev builds of operating systems, there are many different features that may or may not ship that are, some are enabled, some are not enabled, and you can turn them on. Like, it's so many layers of unreliability in here. So please take all this with huge grains of salt.
Yeah. And I love the idea of like two different rumor leakers like bickering between themselves. Right, like, right. No, your unreliable information is wrong. No, your unreliable information is wrong. Like, they're both not super reliable, but they both get things right sometimes.
We'll see after it comes out who's doing the gloating video about all the stuff they got right.
Right, exactly. Yeah, right. But, you know, so, like, you know, as observers and fans here, you can't really judge any details. What seems to be very likely to be true is there is going to be updated designs of some of the system components this fall, but we don't know how deeply that goes. And so I'm actually, when I see the types of things they're reporting, besides the new icon shape, which I think looks, I'm going to assume that their recreation is very wrong because that looks terrible.
Well, but, you know, so here's the thing. In their recreation, it seems like they just took the existing icons and cut more off of the corners. And you would imagine if the new outline was actually a real thing, that the icons themselves would also be changed to accommodate the new outline, because Apple has, unlike the rest of us, Apple has advanced notice about this happening.
Right. But it's, yeah, the way the mock-up is in the video, it's pretty bad. But if you look at, like, okay, what are they doing to the rest of the system? It looks like, you know, we're still going to have, like, you know, tab bars, but they have different style. We're still going to have, you know, like, certain things about it are, like, reskinned or slightly restyled versions of what we already know, but it still generally looks similar. And maybe that's wrong. Again, this is based on sketchy info through many games of telephone. But so maybe it's wrong. But if this is the type of thing we're seeing, that's maybe not what we think of when we think of, like, a whole system redesign. We think of something like iOS 7. And that doesn't seem like that's what this is. This seems like a bunch of visual tweaks and new component layout options that you can use. Like, you know, that floating bottom tab bar is probably going to be, like, one, you know, dot style modifier on Swift UI. It's like, you know, your tab bar, you know, at the bottom, it's like dot tab bar style, parentheses, dot grouped or whatever. You know, like, it'll have some kind of, that's like one style you can choose. Like, that's the way it looks, not as if we're reskinning everything forcibly.
And by the way, on that floating tab bar, what does that floating tab bar remind you of?
Well, it's kind of visiony, but it's more iPad-y. I don't know.
Don't you remember when they redesigned Safari on iOS years ago and there was the weird floaty bar at the bottom?
Yes!
Remember when they tried to do that?
It was terrible!
Everybody said, Here's the thing about this bar. I really hope this mock-up is not a real thing, or if it is, I hope it is a style option that people don't choose. You should watch the video to know what we're talking about, but it's like a floating tab bar at the bottom of the window that it's just like a lozenge that floats. So not only do you see the content above it, but you see a sliver of the content below it and along the sides, because the content is scrolling underneath it, and it's not like anchored to the bottom of the screen. I hate that on phones, because that sliver of content I can see at the bottom does nothing for me except distract me. Like, pin, and it makes the thing take up more room. That was the problem with the old iOS Safari redesign, was like the bottom floating bar floated up, and it's like, give me those pixels back. Just shove the bar down to the bottom of the screen and let me use those pixels for content. Like, why are you making my screen shallower so I can see a sliver of the content as it slides behind the thing and rolls off the end of the screen? Hate it. I hope that's not a real thing, but it's clear that someone at Apple really likes that.
Yeah, I mean, I think the entire era of Johnny Ive and Alan Dye design, like, in the software side, has been, like, obsession with, let's expand the content to every possible edge, even if that means we have to, like, put controls on top of the content, have the content flow around the controls. Like, it's like, we're going to fill everything with background info, basically. And in reality, that is often a bad design. Like, in reality, that...
Yeah, because you're actually getting less content, because that, yes, top part of the tab bar is where the usable content begins. And all that part on the sides and the bottom, that is useless to you. And it's just empty space that's taking away from the content.
Well, and you know, it has a number of other effects, too. Like, it makes everything a lot more visually noisy. It's I think it's harder to kind of visually separate the controls from the content in certain ways. Usually, because the content flows around the sides of it, you need more padding on the sides, which means the actual buttons in the tab bar cannot be as wide as they used to be, so you have smaller touch targets.
And they do, like, a drop shadow. Like, remember, like, the bar casts, like, a shadow on the content, so now you're not even seeing this content as it actually is. You're seeing, like, the shadowed content in the bottom part.
Yeah, or they make something translucent, and you see a blurry color inspired by the content behind it, which changes as you scroll. Like, that also kind of sucks in a few ways. So, like, there's a bunch of weird tricks they do to make these things that look really pretty in marketing shots, but kind of have, you know, worse usability in the real world. But so that's always been like a tension with Apple's design. You know, they try to make things very pretty. They try to hide controls. They try to expand your content to be all the way to the edges. It's all about you. We're going to get out of the way of your content, and we're going to take all the controls and get them out of your way too, so you can't use them. There is some of that, like, yes, that does end up looking very nice in marketing shots. So there is always this balance with Apple, you know, form versus function in their UI designs. And sometimes computers. So we'll see how this turns out. It never goes quite as far into function as nerds like us want it to. There's always a little bit too much form prioritization in some of the UI choices, but that does make the system look nice overall. So, you know, I see why it happens. We often go like a little bit too far in that direction, and I hope they haven't.
A couple other things to note about this, that one of the screenshots that you'll see in the video is Control Center. And this is a place where, like, a more rounded theme, it makes reasonable sense and freshens it up. Like, for example, the big brightness and volume sliders in Control Center. Right now, they're essentially rounded rectangles, big rounded rectangles that you can, you know, like the progress bar type thing to bring the volume up and down and brightness up and down. Now they are semicircular on the top, and the caps are semicircular on the top and the bottom. So increase the corner radius until they meet in the middle. It's, if you had round icons, round top and bottom, sliders for volume and brightness would make sense. The other thing is all of the translucent elements here, including like the control center things and even the icons, have that sort of like beveled edge shimmer. It's as if the icon was made out of a thick material and you'd cut a 45 degree angle bevel around the entire thing and then shined a light on it. That sort of supposedly gyroscopically actuated shimmer. It's not everywhere in the US, but that look of like a piece of glass that has an angled edge that the light is reflecting off of, that is present in all these mockups. And I mean, I think one of the things, based on the Solarium name, all the rumors and these mockups, I think we can safely say that the redesign's theme is glassy stuff, right? Maybe not the same glassy stuff as the Vision Pro, but that it's so clear that that is a strong theme of this redesign, which probably means the same glassy stuff is coming to the Mac even more, which I'm not really looking forward to. And we had, during the show, in fact, some anonymous person send us an idea about, I think this is just an idea and not an attempt to predict or explain. But anyway, the idea is based on our past discussions, like, well, Vision Pro has all these translucent windows because you have pass-through and your windows are floating in the middle of your room. And it's a very different kind of interface. So being able to see partially through things, or at least to have things sort of feel integrated into your environment by showing through the background, makes so much sense in the Vision Pro interface. Maybe less so on phones and Macs. But this anonymous person said, well, you know, that's only true because right now we think of our phones as being like Mac screens where what's behind them is the wallpaper, but the phones do have cameras on the back of them. So technically you could do iPhone pass through. And so that everything that's gracious behind all these translucent things is literally what's behind your phone. To that concept, I think, A, don't give Apple any ideas, and B, I'm assuming that would just destroy your battery. If anyone's ever left the camera app open on your phone for a while, you know that just leaving that app open makes your phone get hot. Now, granted, they don't have to do the massive amount of image processing that the camera app does. They could do a much more dumb one, especially if they're just using it to tint windows with a blurry background. But please, Apple, don't listen to the show and don't do that. It's a terrible idea. But I think about Solarium and a glass look, and I'm like, oh my God, if they could fit that in the battery budget, I just know someone would try to do it. So crossing my fingers, that is not a thing that comes to pass.
All right. So over the last week or so, we've got some exciting news. The Nintendo Switch 2 launch has, launched insofar as we now know what it's going to be. That has happened. And so there was a like 2-hour video, or maybe it was only an hour. It felt forever. I was packing for our spring break trip.
It feels forever because, you know, as WWDC watchers, these are all game demos.
That's true. You're right. You're right. But anyways, there was an hour long video. We'll put a link in the show notes. It's probably worth at least skimming through. But one way or another, the Nintendo Switch 2 is here. Or, well, I keep saying here. But that's not fair. It has been announced. I need to check my vocabulary here. It's been announced. John, as the resident Nintendo expert, how you feeling?
I think I feel good. I think most people feel good. And by the way, the Nintendo Switch 2 was already announced, but this is the reveal where you, last time they just showed the hardware flying around and said, here it is, it's the Switch 2. But now this is more like you would expect at a WWDC announcement where Nintendo gets up there and says, here's the product, here's what it does, here are its features, here are the games that are going to be for it, here's the price, here's the value, like just, it's, you know, completely revealed. If you saw the hardware reveal, there weren't a lot of surprises here. Like, it's a bigger version of the Switch with a bigger, better screen and all the hardware features you could see before, but they talked about a lot of the details. A lot of people got hands-on, so we'll link to The Verge's hands-on and Ars Technica's hands-on, which give a lot of insight into the device from people who actually got to use it. One piece that follow-up for this program is that Marco doubted that the Joy-Cons would be used as mice. In fact, they are usable as mice. Yep, in fact, many of the hands-on things that you'll see reports talk about, how is it to use the Joy-Cons as mice? The answer is, it's weird and not great. What I posted about it on Mastodon when it came out was, Joy-Cons are now mice, controller goes sideways, which is a very old, weird, obscure reference to a tweet back when we cared about what Twitter was like and it was doing weird stuff. The main complaint is if you know what a Switch Joy-Con looks like, putting it on its edge and using it as a mouse is not really comfortable or ergonomic or a great experience. They were pushing it so much at the hands-on that I believe they were, one of the games they were demoing was the new Metroid Prime thing, which is a first-person shooter. And I believe they made you use it in like mouse look mode, essentially. Like, they didn't have controllers. You had to use the Joy-Cons either by, I think, like gyroscoping them in the air or using them as mice. And it's awkward, but I hope this opens the door to, if not first party, then at the very least third party, like actual mouse shape mice for the Switch for people who want to do like first person games with a mouse. It's, as many of the reviews pointed out, it's kind of weird to let you use your controllers as a mouse for a device that people use on their couch. Nintendo even promoted the idea that you can use them on your pants leg. Which, I know, if any of us have been like, before the days of like, if you didn't have consoles or when you tried to like hook up your gaming PC to your TV or something, look, we've all used a mouse on our pants. And who hasn't done it? It's not a good experience. Your leg is not a good mouse pad, especially not for a game where you're doing things like quickly or whatever. Anyway, I thought one of the games they announced was a really interesting use of the Joy-Con mouse control, though, because both Joy-Cons can be used as mice. And it was a wheelchair basketball game, and you use the two mice to essentially like you're grabbing the wheels and rolling them. So to turn, you just push like the right one up a bunch of times, and you swipe, 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 just like you would turn the wheel. And then you use the gyroscope thing to like chuck the ball into the hoop. Look really cool, but a lot of people said their arms were tired. It reminds me kind of the Wii Sports thing. People would be like, video games shouldn't be hurting my arms. What's going on? Exercise. How does it work? Anyway, be careful out there. Another thing that they announced is that it does still have an SD card slot, but it only takes micro SD Express cards, which is a standard that I was not even aware existed. But it basically comes down to they want more speed. Like, the internal SSD is presumably faster. That you can't use the micro SD cards you used with a plain old Switch because they're just too slow. They want to set a minimum standard of speed. It's a low minimum standard. It's not like the PS5 where you need to do 5,500 megabytes per second. Like, that's the PS5's standard, and the console tests any SSD you insert to make sure it complies with that. But micro SD Express is faster than plain old micro SD. The cards cost like twice as much. But anyway, at least there's still expansion. This wasn't something they explained, but by seeing the hardware from more angles and in more of their animations, I think I have a plausible explanation of what the weird chunky things are on the kickstand. I asked this when we talked about the Switch hardware reveal a while back, and it was like, the kickstand is like this kind of U-shaped piece of metal that you fold out from the back of the Switch, and you can put it at different angles. But there were these very thick, like things protruding from the bottom of the kickstand. I didn't understand what they were. Like maybe there was a spring-loaded thing in there or something. That still could be what they are. There still could be some spring mechanism inside there with some mechanical thing that makes the hinge springy and stay in place, kind of like the springs that powered the iMac G4's screen. That could be what's in there. But another function of these things is revealed in the shot where they show the kickstand being put to its maximum like extension, where you start off with the switch at like 90 degrees to the table and you push it down. How flat can you get it? And when you get it real flat, the kickstand goes down, 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 down. At its maximum extension, I think those little nubbin things hit the table as essentially a stop for saying, this is the maximum angle you can get this thing to go. And when you go to that angle, now you have two additional points of contact. I could be wrong because they're not actually touching the table in the photo, but that's my best guess for what those things are. Of all the things in this device, everyone's like, oh, what GPU does it have? What CPU does it have? I'm like, what's inside those hinges? That's what I want to know. They talked more about the magnets that are holding the Joy-Cons on. That seems pretty cool. They did it by making the shoulder buttons on the Joy-Cons be made of metal. So that's what the magnets connect to, which is clever. They didn't say anything about the CPU or GPU. Like, no info revealed there, although they did say it can do 4K 120 frames per second. They did say it uses DLSS, which we discussed on a past program. It's just another one of those fancy upscaling modes to be able to get 4K output when the game is not actually rendered at 4K resolution. The screen on the thing is 1080. It's not an OLED. The output is 4K, again, probably upscalable DLSS. Up to 120 hertz, but I imagine most games will be like 60. The price, we'll talk about this in the after show. The announced price was $450 for the Switch 2, or if you want to get the bundle that comes with Mario Kart World, it's $500. And the top-end games are anywhere from 70 to 80 bucks, which people are flipping out about a little bit. There was a good chart I should have found over the show notes, but I didn't, showing the inflation-adjusted price of video games for home consoles. And I think just a lot of people who are gamers now just expect video games to be $60 forever. But $60 in 1993 is worth a different amount than $60 today. And if you see the chart, you'll see the games used to be way more expensive than they are now. And they've been dropping like a stone relative to inflation. This adjustment does not bring them back to their historic highs. But you can't just expect to live decades and decades and have video games be $60 for that entire time. That's not how inflation works. So they're 70 to 80 bucks now. People are angry about it. It's like, well, welcome to the world. Some things do actually get more expensive. In fact, most things get more expensive. This is an example. They're not selling you when you buy the game, you're not buying the cost of goods for the cartridge. And by the way, it still does use little tiny cartridges, although they're selling a kind of cartridge that basically just has a decryption key on it. So it's like a hardware dongle for the game because they want to be able to sell physical things in stores, but they don't want to actually put the game on the thing because it's too big to fit on the cart. Anyway, there's lots of weird stuff going on there. But suffice it to say, our all digital age is rapidly coming for all consoles, but Nintendo is still holding strong by willing to sell you a tiny little card that you can trade with people and sell when you're done with it, and you know all the good things you can do with physical games, even if there's not actually a physical game on it. They announced a bunch of things about trading games to other people. Like, what if I have a game and I'll let someone borrow it? They're doing some more digital DRM powered lending library things. Basically all good news. From my perspective, I looked at this announcement, I'm like, Switch 2 looks great. Looks like a Switch, but better. The games look good. I don't blink at the price because I just bought a $700 PS5 Pro. I don't expect things to cost the same amount forever. Didn't expect them to launch this at $199. Presumably the price will go down over time. I think it's just, I looked at the announcement, I said, this is like a home run. I'm totally going to get one of these and I think I will really like it. Will it actually be $450 or $500, or will it be much, much more? Nintendo was taking sort of pre-orders. They did a clever thing where they're trying to stop people from like buying them up and then reselling them, essentially, like, I don't know what you'd call it, scalpers in ticket parlance. They didn't want people buying up a bunch of Switches and then selling them for tons of money. So I guess you can only do this trick once, but they basically said, if you want to put your name in the hat to get in line to be able to have the privilege of pre-ordering this at some point, you have to have a Nintendo Online account with at least $50 of gameplay on the Switch.
50 hours.
50 hours of gameplay on the Switch, which I easily pass, and I put my hat in the ring. And then 2 days later, they said, based on this tariff stuff, maybe we're going to hold off on those pre-order things. We'll have more to say later. So as usual, everything is completely up in the air and uncertain because of the chaos in our country. We apologize to the whole world for that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
See, we'll talk about them more on the after show. But anyway, Switch 2 looks good, right?
I mean, if we can ever actually get one, I think this is going to be like the fun that we need. Like, I feel like a major heyday of the Switch 1 was 2020, with, you know, everyone being stuck at home, and then Animal Crossing came out.
Mm-hmm.
And that was like such kind of a hallmark of like we needed that at that time. This kind of like, you know, helpful, you know, calm, semi-social game. Like, it, I think that helped the world out. And for Nintendo to be releasing this year, which is going to have what looks like a really fun new Mario Kart game and whatever else they're going to be doing over the next couple of years with titles, I think this will be nice to have this year. We're all going to need it.
Oh, that Mario Kart game. What a good idea. I don't know why this never occurred to me, but when they announced it, I'm like, oh, duh. What a good idea. So what they, you know, with Breath of the Wild, they basically made Zelda an open world game, which seems like it should never possibly work, but totally did. And it was amazing and everyone loved it. They made Mario Kart an open world game. You're like, what the hell? It's a game where you race carts around a track. How can that be an open world game? They said, well, guess what? Now you can drive anywhere. Now there's a mode where you and your friends can just go drive places. It's not even the race. And some of the racing modes, you drive around one course and then you drive to the next course and then you drive around it and then you drive. Yeah. It's such a good idea. Like, just I full credit for them to saying, we, you know, open world is fun. Can we add that to a driving game? And the answer is yes. Love it.
Yeah. I was a little worried, like whenever I see like the promotional videos or teaser images of a Mario Kart game, like a new Mario Kart game, it always looks to me like just total like overload mania. Like every new one that comes out, my first impression when I see the videos is, oh God, they added way too much crap to this. This doesn't look fun anymore. Now it's just like a coin fest.
Sometimes you're right that they did add way too much crap.
But, fair, you know. But when like and when I saw like, you know, the very first teaser video for this, I was like, oh God, they just covered this. And like it looked to me like the feeling when you get like when you're walking through a casino and you're hearing all this, the slot machine ding, 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 like it just that to me is like when I see these Mario Kart promo videos. But then I saw like later on some other video they did, I saw like actual gameplay footage of just like a race, and it looked a lot more normal. I'm like, oh, thank God. Okay, so.
And reportedly, they've toned down the items. Like, in the old games, like, for example, if you got hit with an offensive item, it would essentially stop you dead in your tracks. You'd have to reaccelerate. And due to, like, the nature of, like, the various modes they have, like knockout mode, where you have to be in a certain place, otherwise you get knocked out of the race as you go from course to course, it's reportedly, from the people who have tried the game, fewer things that like, oh, I got hit with this, now I'm just dead in the water, I'm totally stopped. It's more like things will hit you and slow you down. So that seems gentler as well, where I'm not sure it's saying you're not going to get frustrated, because I think I saw one item that randomly swaps the place of people in the race, which I think will anger a lot of people in a fun way, maybe. But I'm looking forward to longer races where getting hit with a single item doesn't feel like, well, I might as well just stop now because I've gone from 100 miles an hour to zero.
Yeah.
They did make the maximum number of players up to 24 or something, which is probably a little bit ridiculous.
Now, I'm very much looking forward to it. I don't expect to get one for less than $1,000 in the next 2 years.
But yeah, that remains to be seen. Like, how attainable will these actually be? That's a big question mark.
Yeah, I mean, it's a question. Even without the current political instability in our country, just getting the original Switch was difficult in much more favorable circumstances. So if you think getting the Switch 2 is going to be easy, it was never going to be easy. And now it may be even harder. But, you know, like if you can get one, you can get one. If you can't, trust me, eventually Switch 2s will be in stock and you'll be able to buy one. Nintendo will make sure of it eventually. Maybe next year, maybe the year after that. But you just stay alive no matter what occurs. Switch 2 will find you. That's a reference, Casey.
I got nothing. All right. The iPhone 17 Pro allegedly will have a new 48-megapixel telephoto lens. Reading from Mac Rumors, according to Majin Boo, the iPhone 17 Pro will feature a new telephoto lens with a 48-megapixel sensor, up from the current 12-megapixel sensor found in the iPhone 16 Pro and Pro Max. This rumor isn't new. In fact, it's been repeatedly claimed by several other sources. However, Boo goes further by claiming that the new lens will offer 3.5x optical zoom, which is an 85mm equivalent, instead of the 5x zoom or 120mm equivalent currently available. The big shift allegedly comes from the new 48-megapixel sensor in that the extra resolution allows for digital cropping to simulate longer focal lengths, offering less quality loss than normal digital zoom. This is similar to what Apple already does with the main Fusion camera on the iPhone 16, where the 48-megapixel sensor enables a 2x digital crop marketed as telephoto that still produces a 12-megapixel image with minimal quality loss. I don't think I do and I don't want this. I don't want to lose my 1.5x. I really like the 5x zoom. And maybe I would find in use that I would actually prefer the 3.5, but I like having the throw of the 5. I'm glad that I have 5x, and I think I would miss it if I didn't have it anymore.
But you're going to have it. Like, that's the thing. Remember we talked about the 5x originally, and I think even when you, you were the first one of us to get it and you were trying it out, it's like, well, it's great when you need the reach, but the thing about 5x is you can always like zoom in a little bit more by using like quote unquote digital zoom that kids do. They don't know it's destroying their photos. But you can't zoom out any farther. You have to switch to another camera. If you don't want 5x, you have to switch off the 5x camera. And now you're in, you know, the 1x, 2x camera or whatever, and you're doing tons of digital zoom. I think this sounds great because making it 3.5x optical, but with the like the double pixel thing of the 48 going down to 12 megapixel to get 5x, it's basically the same.
With
our current 1x camera, when you switch to the quote unquote 2x camera, it's still the 1x camera. They're just pixel binning and cropping and doing like they're just giving you the middle 12 megapixels out of not pixel binning. They're giving you the middle 12. It's sensor cropping. And they can get away with it because the sensor is good enough that a sensor crop still looks pretty good. They do a bunch of tricks. We talked about this when the camera first came out to make it look better than just a straight up sensor crop of the thing. Because I like the 5X thing, but when I use it on my like, all right, when I'm trying to take pictures of my dog, she's doing something cute on her bed and I'm on the couch. this is just a me problem. 5X is a little bit too zoomed in. Right? Yeah. But 2x is a little bit too far out. And then you got to do, okay, well, do I digital zoom from the 2x even more? Because I can't digital zoom out from the 5x. If I had an optical 3.5x, I could pick it. I hope this rumor is true because I think it's a great compromise between the current 5x while still giving people 5x reach. I'm assuming the camera is good quality, but also giving more of the in-between ranges.
I'm looking forward to this if this is true. I love having the reach of the 5X sometimes, but oftentimes it is way too much reach. But as John said, the 2X is not quite enough. And so I find myself, you know, just digitally zooming on the 2X sometimes between 2 and 5 or whatever. But the 5X lens, like, it has always been the telephoto lens on an iPhone, no matter what it was, back when it was 2X, when it was 2.5X, when it was 5X, I think it was 3 somewhere on some phones sometimes. That lens has always been optically a pretty big compromise. The pictures it takes are not great. It is way less, you know, detail and way more noise compared to the big main, you know, 1X camera lens. Part of that is because of megapixels. A bigger part of that's because of optics and physics of like how you have to fit that and everything. So if they change this to a 48-megapixel sensor, that will improve some of that. It's not going to make it as good as the 1X lens still because of the optics and the physics differences, but it will at least make it better. And if they switch it to a 3.5X or whatever sensor, like physically, and then you digital zoom to 5X, I think the resulting quality of the 5X images is probably not going to be that noticeably different or worse or better than the current 5X lens with its 12-megapixel sensor and its current optics. So I think this is only a positive change, most likely. And then the advantage will be that you get a much better image quality at that middle range. Like when you actually are shooting at 3.5 or 4 or whatever, like that will be much better quality than it is today, probably. So this sounds promising to me. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, I didn't realize that it was in addition to 5X. I mean, well, sort of, kind of. I thought they were canning the 5X in favor of 3.5. I see totally now what you're saying. I totally missed the boat on this, in that, you know, it's a digital crop or a sensor crop. This sounds much better than I initially thought. And yeah, I'm definitely here for it.
Well, a couple more tidbits on 17 Pro that aren't in the notes here, but that happened this week or recently. We've talked in the past episodes about the sort of elongated camera mesa, where they just took the existing one and they just said, let's just extend that mesa all the way across the phone. Let's just be honest. But they left all the cameras in the same place and they just put like the flash and the LiDAR sensor way on the right side. Anyway, people are coming out. More people are making those models. Like, that's what we were looking at last time we talked about in the show. Someone had made like physical models of it, and we were looking at those CAD drawings and the models made from them while we were discussing it. People are making models, and case manufacturers are making cases. The cases look hilarious, with just basically the top third of the case just open for the giant camera mesa to come in. I know, like, we're used to seeing a big hole in the back of a case, but now it's just like edge to edge. Top third of the camera is just entirely open in the back. Some other rumors that people are now insisting that the camera mesa, unlike all the mockups that people have been making, will not be a different color than the back of the phone. It'll just be whatever color the back of the phone is, the camera mesa will be that same color. Maybe that's a way to try to hide its bulk. Maybe it's just a new look. There's rumors about it, the back of the phone being partially aluminum and partially glass, with glass over the parts that need to be radio transparent, but aluminum over, or some other kind of metal over the other parts for sturdiness. So that's kind of the state of the rumors now. Like, the CAD drawings are so widely available that you'll find so many YouTube videos where, like, I made it out of metal. I made these out of wood. I 3D printed them. Like, people have these phones essentially in their hand. Case manufacturers are making cases for them. Like, the thorough leaking of the physical design of iPhones continues to just be massive and unavoidable. Like, I almost feel bad for if, like, you actually care about this and you want to be like remain spoiler free about what the new iPhones look like. It's almost impossible if you ever use YouTube, but, or listen to the show. Sorry about that. But anyway, those are the new phones that are coming. But if, like, that 3.5x camera, like, I'm excited about. I'm not even getting this phone. Is anyone getting this phone? Anyway, we'll talk more in the after show.
We are sponsored this episode by DeleteMe. DeleteMe makes it easy, quick, and safe to remove your personal data online at a time when surveillance and data breaches are common enough to make everyone vulnerable. Now, if you go and search your own name in a search engine, you're going to find pretty quickly how easy it is for anybody to find out your home address, your phone number, you know, personal info about, like, your relatives, or, like, it's really creepy really fast. And the reason why this is so out there and so easy is because there's these data brokers that are compiling this information and publishing it on websites and trying to get people to, you know, pay money for upgrades and all this stuff. And it's this huge business trading your data around. It's a commodity. Anybody can quickly get it, either for free or by paying a bit of money. You can get all this information, and it's creepy. DeleteMe goes around to all these data broker sites and opts you out. They go through the process of, like, filling out the takedowns, the opt-outs, the, you know, the legal, whatever it is. You tell DeleteMe, go remove my info from everything out there. And they will go to all these different data brokers that they know about, hundreds of data brokers, and they will file all those takedowns for you. So it dramatically reduces the amount of your info that's easily findable on the web. So see for yourself, take control of your data, and keep your private life private by signing up for DeleteMe. Now at a special discount for our listeners. Today, get 20% off your DeleteMe plan by texting ATP to 64,000. The only way to get 20% off is to text ATP to 64,000. That's ATP to 64,000. Message and data rates may apply. Thanks so much to DeleteMe for sponsoring our show.
Okay, let's do some Ask ATP. And Robert Batow writes, what resources do you use for reviews, whether it's for purchases or anything else? I use Wirecutter for purchases, but I have no idea what else would be reliable. I don't really have a good answer for this. I don't even remember the last time I looked for, like, proper reviews of something. Typically, I'll page through Amazon reviews if I'm looking at something on Amazon, which are all garbage and fake. And then I'll, you know, maybe Google for a second. But I don't have any terribly good answers for this. I feel like John is going to have the most comprehensive response. So, Marco, what do you do?
Well, actually, before you move on, Casey, I have a question for you about this. Mm-hmm. What's the last thing you can recall buying that you, like, that you bothered to do any kind of, like, research for?
I mean, we've just replaced both of our refrigerators, our garage and indoor refrigerator. They both died simultaneously, which was very unfun. But I didn't do that much research. I mean, I did some cursory looking about, but we knew that we wanted to get something from Costco because they were running President's Day sales at the time. And then for the garage fridge, I think they literally had one option, which was fine. And then for the indoor fridge, they had like three or four options that we cared about. And I just chose the one that best fit our needs. So there really wasn't that much comparison shopping done. Before then, I don't even know, like Aaron's car, but we comparison shopped ourselves and decided we wanted to stick with an XC90. Like I'm not trying to dodge your question. It's a completely fair question.
No, because like we all know people who like just don't do research for their purchases because that's just not the way they live their life. And especially if you don't have hobbies that intersect with your purchases, like asking you, Casey, where did you do research for your next computer? Like, you don't have to do that research. You're living in it. You're soaking in it all the time. You are aware of the Macs that are available and are coming and what their resources are. Like, you don't have to do any research for that because it's part of your hobby. But your hobby is not researching refrigerators. So when your refrigerator breaks, two things. One, as you know from listening to RecDiffs, when your refrigerator breaks, you don't really have time to leisurely research what kind of fridge you're going to get. You kind of need a place to put your food so it doesn't spoil. And then two, like maybe you don't care that much about refrigerators. That's what most people are with most of their purchases, is like, well, whatever. I just want one that's okay and that doesn't cost too much and they're having a sale. And so I go for it. But yeah, some people care a lot about every purchase and some people care not at all about any purchase. And some people only care about the things that they're already like, they don't have to do research for because it's their hobby. Like, so you care about which computers you get, but you do not have to actively do any research in that area.
Yeah. Marco, let's talk with you, and then John, let's wrap it up with you, please.
So the key to sifting through reviews is you have to be able to kind of contextualize the credibility of what you are seeing. And there's two angles to that. Like, one of them is just like, is this even real? And, you know, do I trust this person or alleged person? And do I trust what they're saying to be accurate and fair? And the second part of it is, are they looking for the same things I'm looking for in this product? And those are very different questions. And you have to really be aware of both those things. Like, you know, so where you are looking has a certain set of like, you know, built-in things to consider. Like on Amazon, many of those reviews are fake. Many of those reviews have been paid for. Many of them were given like the Amazon Vine program where they send them the product for free in exchange for a review. Like, there's so much gaming going on there, or incentivizing going on in any kind of online shop, but especially Amazon, which is so big. So you do have to contextualize. When you see a review, it's like, this looks like a, you know, a three paragraph essay written by a middle schooler about this product. Like, chances are that's not, you know, that anything that looks kind of formulaic, and you know, it's like, this is probably not a real thing that you need to be paying attention to. Similarly, you have to consider like, what is the crowd I am watching, or what is the crowd I'm reading here? Like, for instance, if you find like Reddit posts about something you're buying, well, most Reddits seem to be young men who are angry about the products they're reviewing. And so it's like, well, that can be useful. Like, that's very good information sometimes. But you have to contextualize, like, well, what are young angry men saying about this? Like, or you know, what, when this product breaks or doesn't work, like, what, how does it break and not work? But if you don't look at if you don't contextualize it properly, you might think like, oh, this product breaks for everybody. But what if it only breaks for young men? You wouldn't know that. Like, so you have to contextualize. Like, you know, so Amazon, a lot of fake stuff. You know, other places online, like, they have their communities and their limitations and everything. So what you're looking for when you see reviews is overall trends, large trends. Like, okay, well, if this product, if all the reviews of this are citing like some nitpicky problem, but it has like 10,000 reviews on Amazon and the average is like 4.5 stars, odds are it works fine for most people who buy it, and the few people it doesn't, there's what they're complaining about. And you can read the reviews and say, like, okay, well, it looks like, you know, this cheese grater, it looks like it's really good, but maybe the handle breaks off under heavy use after 5 years. Like, okay, well, you might still want to buy it, like, because that might still be the best cheese grater. That's why everyone keeps buying it. Right? So, like, you have to kind of contextualize, like, well, how will this fit my needs, not just what does one reviewer say? And again, you have to look at the credibility of the reviewer. So if you're looking at, like, a restaurant, my favorite is, like, if you're, like, you know, in America, and you see reviews for any kind of non-American food. Like, you look at, like, reviews for, like, a Thai restaurant, say. Well, you can always tell when you look at those reviews, like, which of these people don't really eat Thai food? You can tell right there in the reviews. Because they'll make certain comments like, oh, they're judging this harshly, but somebody who likes Thai food, that sounds like they probably like it, actually. So you have to, you know, contextualize that kind of thing as well with reviews. So it's, I can't just point to one place and say, this is the one, trust what this place is saying, because everywhere has their problems. Even, yes, Wirecutter. Wirecutter, despite the marketing of it, does not test a huge number of products in most categories. They usually test, they'll usually do the same thing, you know, they'll go on Amazon or whatever, and they'll, like, kind of filter out, like, what they don't even want to bother testing, because you can't test everything, because there's so many products in most categories. So, like, they'll use their own kind of filtering, you know, methods to say, all right, well, we're only going to test, like, these 10 things in this category or whatever. And even then, they're testing for certain qualities, they're optimizing for certain qualities, they're only having a small number of people usually do the testing. So even then, like, that's not going to be representative of what everyone is looking for. That's not going to be representative of every product in the market. They might rule things out based on, you know, price or availability details that maybe you don't care about. Or they might not care about some feature or some functionality of something that you very much do care about. You know, so you kind of have to just look around and get a vibe for, like, oh, it seems like most people pick this option. Why? Or it seems like this product seems to perform poorly in cold weather. Well, I live in Arizona. No problem. You know, like, you can find stuff out like that, but you do have to kind of just develop that habit of just, like, being able to absorb a lot of info that you're seeing from all these different sources, being able to pretty quickly realize what seems credible and what seems non-credible, and then what seems relevant and what seems irrelevant.
John.
The reason I put this in Ask ATP is because this is one of the questions we get every few years. We get all the time, but every few years I feel like it's worth re-answering it just to see if anything has changed in our lives in terms of how we handle things, and just to reiterate the answers that we usually give to these questions for listeners who haven't listened to the program for years and years. I think you two covered most of the bases there, and I already talked about, like, you can't do deep research on every single thing you buy. Like, you probably only care about certain things, and other ones you just, like, I feel like a lot of people have that sort of the loss aversion where they're like, well, I don't care about this, but I don't want to get a bad one. It's like, well, like, what are the consequences? You know, if you're looking for, like, a garbage can for your office, if you get a bad one, it's probably not the end of the world. Just put it in, use it somewhere else in your house where it will work better, and try again, right? Versus buying a refrigerator or a car where you're like, well, I don't actually even care about cars, but it's a lot of money, so I want to make sure I do okay there, so I'm going to do some research. So always recognize that balance. Like, if you find yourself doing days of research about cheese graters and you don't actually care about cheese graters, question what you're doing. Right? You should only research the things that you actually, you know, either that you care a lot about or you feel like you have to care a lot about because the consequences of making a bad choice are, you know, significant. But again, the consequences of buying a trash can for your office that you don't like that much, probably not going to be fatal. So you'll probably be okay. The resources that I use, I think it always helps for things that you do care about and you want to research. It always helps to sort of, first of all, find the place on the internet where the people who care way more about this than you hang out and talk about it. So for me, like, for televisions, there are whole forums of people who just, like, spend all day talking about TV, like, talking about things, like, on their little, you know, PHBBB that's been up for decades, and they are just obsessed with TVs, and they have dedicated topics and channels for specific manufacturers and models, and they share settings with each other, and they're obsessively watching all the rumors about, like, those people care more. Their lives are about TV. This is the ATP listener equivalent. Like, that's the ATP for televisions. You probably want to find those people, not because you're going to agree with them or do what they say, but it's good to have that input of, like, there are some people who are on top of everything, and their opinions are going to be weird, and their priorities are not going to match yours, but they do know a lot. And so that really helps with, like what Marco was saying, if you're like, well, this, you know, the Wirecutter cares about X, but doesn't care at all about Y. And when you find the people who care a ton about the product, you will see every concern reflected somewhere in there. So if you're wondering, like, I care about how noisy this thing is, but no one ever talks about the noise, find the forums where everyone's obsessed. There's going to be a subgenre in there of the people who care about the noise. The Wirecutter review may never even mention or measure the noise at all, but the forum full of people who are obsessed with this thing. They're going to talk about the noise, the weight, the color, the price, like they're going to talk about everything. So if I want to know how noisy is this, you need somewhere to find that information, not from the specs page of the thing and not from some paid review on Amazon, but like the obsessive people. So find that. Find where that is, whether it's a website or whatever. Find the people who are obsessed and don't take what they say at face value. Don't look at their recommended products and buy what they say, but instead use it as a resource to figure out, the thing that I care about, let me get some info on that so I can put that as an input into my thing. Second thing that I'll say is YouTube is a great resource when buying physical products, because almost anything you buy, you'll probably be able to find multiple YouTube reviews of it. And the thing you're getting, I think the most important thing to get from a YouTube review, if you're not lucky enough to like find like a YouTube channel that you trust and about this product or whatever, which is not always going to be the case, you just want to physically see the product in real conditions, in real lighting, in real people's hands. And boy, will you find that on YouTube. And you may not think like, well, what do I care? Like, I know what it looks like. I see the pictures on the website. Like, what does it matter? Seeing the real thing, maybe if they use the thing, if it's like a vacuum, having them like use it and push it around and just like seeing it from lots of different angles. And like the product shots are always going to show it in the most flattering light. And maybe you'll get two blurry photos on the Amazon reviews with photos things. YouTube is where you need to go to see this product from all angles.
Yeah.
Again, to use as an input, because you're wondering like, is that thing on the bottom pointy? Like, how does this thing rest on the table? Or where does the plug go in on this? Or what is what does that display look like when it lights up? Or does that thing make a noise when you turn it on? You will find the answers to those questions on YouTube, because you'll search for this product and model number, and you'll find 100 amateur videos from random people in their houses, and eventually one of them will show the thing that you're interested in. That is another important input. And then finally, if you're super lucky and it's a thing that you really care about, you will eventually find channels that you like. When I was searching for speakers for my home theater setup, and then later when I was searching speakers for my computer, there are channels that I like and follow that review audio equipment where I've watched like dozens of hours of reviews of audio stuff. And I know those people. I know what their attitudes are and what they care about. I know where to find the objective measures that I care about for the particular speakers that I'm interested in. And boy, is that nice. Because if I just like, or my whole AV setup, when I was looking at my receiver and the television channels, like if it's a big name thing, like lots of people are into TVs, lots of people are into gaming monitors, lots of people are into building PCs, chances are good there are a handful of YouTube channels where you can eventually find the people that you feel like you trust, that give you that whose values kind of match yours. And that could be a shortcut to all of this, because you're like, I'm just going to go to Monitors Unbox, and whatever he says is the best gaming monitor that is, 4K 27 inch OLED with HDR with this number of nits, I'm just going to say whichever one he says is the best, I'm just going to get, because I've watched this guy for 7 years and his values align with mine. Shortcut, I know exactly what to get. If you don't know Hardware Unbox exists, you can't take that shortcut. But eventually, for things that you care about, you will find a channel like that.
Anonymous writes, I'm having my first child soon. I want to figure out a coherent plan for managing and backing up pictures. Well, why are you talking to us? All right, next question. no, I kid. Anonymous continues, ideally, it should work automatically without me having to do anything. If manual steps are required, I will definitely be too lazy to do them. I take pictures with my iPhone and Android phone, and my wife takes pictures with her iPhone. I'm not worried if it costs some money. Google Photos, I guess. I mean, we do have a whole member special about this that I recommend you ignore everything that we talk about in that special.
Well, we just explain what we do, but we're not, again, with most of our member specials, when we explain what we do in our lives, we're not necessarily recommending that you do the same thing. We're just explaining what we do.
Yeah. So I honestly am not sure, other than maybe Google Photos, like I said, I'm not sure what I would recommend.
Yeah. The last bit of like, it says I take pictures with my iPhone and Android phone. There you go. Well, once you say iPhone and Android, you need something cross-platform, because the whole point is I don't want to do anything manual. So any solution that's like, just your iPhone will be your primary phone and you use iCloud photo library, and then your Android photos, you'll just transfer. Nope, manual step. No good. So if you want it to be automated, it's slim pickings. You need a photo system that works hands-off on both iOS and Android. And the first one that comes to mind, Casey just said it, Google Photos. Google Photos is on the iPhone, Google Photos is on Android, and it is a fairly comprehensive photo system that cloud syncs your photos and yada, yada, yada. And that's literally the only thing I can think of, because everything else has manual steps. I'm not even aware of any other service that tries to compete at the level of Google Photos across both of these platforms. Now, if you could ditch that Android phone, I'd have a different answer for you. But given the constraints, you are looking at cross-platform solutions. And honestly, Google Photos is not bad. Like, it's fine. Like, you know, and it'll do, I think, what you need to do. But be aware that Google Photos integration in the iOS ecosystem is not as smooth as the integration of Apple's own photo system. So you will have to deal with that. But that's just, that's fact of life. There's no avoiding it. I don't think there's any other, I'm not aware of any other service that will, I guess maybe like there's an Amazon thing where they'll sync your photos. I forget if they canceled that. I'm sure people are going to write in with their third-party solutions. But honestly, with the whole like, there can't be manual steps, I would add the other caveat is I don't want to use a company that might not be there in 5 years. Like if you're trying to look for pictures of your kids, like I wouldn't trust this to, not that I'm not to denigrate any third party things, but both platforms, both Apple's platforms and Google's platform, and Microsoft's platform for that matter, don't really bend over backwards to make sure that third parties can provide as reliable a solution to photo management and sharing as the first party ones. They just don't. You're lucky you can do it at all. And so that's why there's not a proliferation of third-party services that work across all these platforms as seamlessly as the first-party ones. Google is really the only thing I can think of that has pretty okay iOS integration and, of course, you know, very good Android integration and is a reliable service. And I know Google has a reputation for abandoning all their products. If they eventually abandon Photos, it's going to make a lot of people sad. But, like, given the constraints of your question, Anonymous, I don't have any better solutions.
Yertle writes, do you guys have any strategies or philosophies around documenting complex setups that others might need to support, like Marco's wiring layout and network config for the restaurant? I'm mostly thinking of how much you try to support your future selves. Do you just bank it on it all making sense enough for you to figure out later? Other examples are AV receiver wiring and cloud or local backup steps. For me, generally speaking, I'll create like an Apple note when it's something that I think I want to refer to in the future. I'm trying to think of other more physical examples. When I redid the switches in the house, that gave me an excuse to go figure out what all the different fuses in the fuse box or breaker box, whatever you want to call it, what they correspond to. So I made a little ASCII like table that matches the breaker box and, you know, says, you know, breaker one is the bedroom and breaker two is the bathroom or whatever the case may be. For my website, as another silly example, when I moved to Linode, I was very diligent about documenting all the things I did in order to make sure I knew how to do it again in the future, because I knew I'd never remember any of it. Although, quick aside, I've been meaning to tell you two, you can finally stop yelling at me about something that is not a problem. You can go to barebonesjustcaseylist.com and it will now work. It used to be in the past that it would not work. It would hang, if I'm not mistaken. You had to go to www.caseylist.com. Now you can go to justcaseylist.com and that will also work.
Welcome to 2002.
Yeah, well, thank you very much. It's great to be here. At least our president sort of kind of makes a little bit of sense. Actually, wasn't it W then? Maybe that's not true. Anyway, the point is that what made me think of this was I was looking at how I set up the Let's Encrypt like cron job or whatever it was I did in order to set up the SSL cert for my website because I needed to rejigger that a little bit. And as it turns out, that was the one thing I didn't document very well at all. And so as I was going through the stance of trying to figure out what the heck it was I did and how to augment it to allow for, you know, like a bare bones domain, I then documented it. And this happens to be a wiki entry on the GitHub repository for my website. But generally speaking, I use Apple Notes religiously and diligently to document these sorts of things. That being said, it's not really helpful for anyone else. So God forbid if I drop dead tomorrow, Aaron or whoever's coming after me to clean all this up is going to be, it's going to be a mess for them. Like they you know, Aaron has access to my Apple Notes if she wants it, but it's still going to be difficult. But that being said, that's not going to be my problem. So I don't know. We started with Marco last time, I believe. John, what do you have any thoughts on this?
One of the things I rely on for doing this is my own deterministic nature. If there is any situation where I feel like if I encountered it again in the future, I would just have to do what comes natural to me and it would solve the problem. So for example, let me keep track of like how I did this or what I named this thing or where I put this. I will come upon the same situation years later and just say, oh, well, I don't know how I did this or where I put it or what I called it before, but I'll just do what I feel like doing. And lo and behold, that's exactly what I did 5 years ago, because I am the same person and I'm very predictable in certain ways. I don't bother documenting that stuff. I just trust in myself to make the same decision if I need to. I do document for things that are not like that I don't have any kind of strong feeling about, and therefore my deterministic nature is not going to help me here. I do have an Apple note, for example, where I keep a bunch of crap in my house, things that really should be leaving my house, see other podcasts that I do. But I just have so much crap. I need to get rid of so much of it. But in the meantime, sometimes I need to know where something is. And so I have a notes document that tells me like, oh, this, I think the first year I really started doing this was like, it was hiding Christmas presents. Like I'd get early Christmas presents, but I didn't want people to find them, so they'd hide them. And then like in February, I'd find something that I forgot to give someone on Christmas, you know, buried in a drawer somewhere. Then I said, you know what? I need to write this down because I'm old and apparently I can't remember where I put this stuff. So I will do that kind of documentation for technical stuff, or for like, you know, the examples here, like wiring and like my AV stuff or whatever. Most of that stuff, I assume, documenting it is not useful because the next time I touch it, I'm going to be overhauling it anyway. So who cares what I did before? And that has proved to be true for most things. Like I may have a complicated setup. My setup on my AVs thing is, I don't know, it's not complicated, but it is involved. But if I ever touch it, it's because I'm overhauling it again. And then I just want to start from scratch anyway. Right. So that I don't document that stuff. You mentioned like doing SSL stuff. That's one of the few things I do have documented in my website things, just because it was every time I did it, it'd be like, well, how would this work again? And what did I do? Because you just forget about it, especially when the certs were like 5 years. Remember back before you had to redo it every year, when you could have an SSL cert for 5 years. 5 years roll around, and you're like, oh, I have no idea what I did for this last time. I should have documented it. Well, I did document it, and now I have to do it every year for multiple sites, and that is convenient. And by documenting, it's usually just a matter of writing down instructions, but then I'm like, you know what, why don't I just make this a shell script? And you know, anyway, most everything else, no, like I'm kind of in the same situation as you, Casey. I make this joke to my family all the time, like, if I get hit by a bus, you guys are never gonna be able to watch TV again, which sounds bad. It's like, what do you have such a complicated setup that no one in your house can figure it out? I promise you it's not that complicated, but they just rely on me to deal with it. Like I'm like their TV concierge. It's like, you know, you there, man, turn on my television program. And I do, like, it's just, you know, or if anything ever goes wrong, something's wrong with the computer, television, anything that is a remotely computer thing, they just throw up their hands and walk away, and then I solve it for them. So if I ever disappear, they're just, I don't know, they're going to be Amish or something. It's going to be a rough situation for them. But yeah, I guess I write down what the breakers are for inside the breaker box on the little lines where they say to write that stuff down. I'm the only one who does that because no one else ever touches the breaker box. But yeah, I guess that's the extent. Like the real answer to this question is, do you have philosophies for documenting complex setups, or do you do it? Like the answer is I don't do it enough. Whatever amount I'm doing it is clearly not enough, but I get by.
I mean, I think that's how we all are. Like with this stuff, like, you know, you do your best, but every system, like you maybe like forget about it a little bit, or you get a little sloppy. Like the breakers are a great example. You know, the breaker labeling is, in most cases, it's required by code for new construction or renovation. But like, of course, over time, the breaker labeling diverges from reality.
Yeah, it becomes fiction, yeah.
Right, or rather reality diverges from the labeling usually. Or like, you know, that was how it was when it was first installed. But then like, well, you know, a few weeks later, some circuit had to be moved for some reason, or you added more circuits and now you have like six unlabeled breakers at the bottom of the box that do who knows what. You know, reality always interferes with these systems. Like, you know, even, you know, so the questioner asks, like, what am I doing about the wiring and network config at the restaurant? Well, I started out with all the best intentions. When I ran all the new wires, I labeled them with Label Maker. I wrapped little labels around them, both ends of each one, with a naming scheme that I think makes sense. What happens is over time, like, oh, I got to replace this wire with a longer one. Oh, I'll label that later this afternoon when I get back to it. Oh, then I forgot. Mm-hmm. Then it's gone. Then now we have like three wires that aren't labeled. Or like, oh, well, let me just connect this real quick to test it, and then I'll, you know, put the real wire in later with the real label, and then that time never comes. Now I did, like, you know, I made like a diagram of the building and like what, you know, where each wire goes. Like I have like the main, like, I call them the trunk wires, the main like big ones that go like from kind of the sub switches to the main switch. those are labeled as, you know, trunk one, trunk two, trunk three. And I have a map. I have like a PDF that has like an overview map of the floor plan, and it labels where trunk one and trunk three, like where those go, where the switches are. Well, but now I have more switches than that. Do I go back and update that PDF? Yes. And, you know, now I have it. But like in 6 months or 3 years, when something has to be added or changed or replaced, am I going to go back and update that PDF? Probably not, if I can still even find
it. Are you going to be able to find that PDF, which is another problem with documenting things? Then you have to remember where you put the documentation or whether it exists or what it was called or how it was organized.
Right. And if somebody down the road has to do this without me, are they going to even know to look for something like that? Probably not. They're probably going to just look at the system the way it is and figure it out as best as they can. You know, and that's you know, one example where like it's kind of hard to run everything new. You know, your example, like AV receiver wiring, John's right. The only way to ever edit AV receiver wiring is to disconnect everything, pull it all out, and do it all again.
Probably should, because there's probably wires that are no longer connected to anything that have been behind your TV for years.
Almost certainly. And you should at least vacuum everything back there. So, you know, that's... I feel like the answer really is, like, you do your best. Every system kind of breaks down over time, and you figure it out. And if it's irritating you on a frequent basis, then you put a new system in. You know, you label everything all from scratch. You know, you take a day and you test all your circuit breakers and you figure out what goes to what and you label them all. Odds are it won't be that important to you ever. Like, that day will never come that that's a good idea for you to spend your time doing that. And you'll just plow through and it'll be fine.
And there is an anti-pattern to watch out for here for, like, I think what we're representing is kind of like middle of the road. A lot of people kind of live their lives this way. There are people who care much more about this process. And if it's not hobby, if it's a hobby for you and you enjoy it, fine, whatever. But like, some people feel like they need to laboriously, carefully document every aspect of their lives. And almost certainly, if it is not a thing that they enjoy in a hobby, they are burning time that could be better used doing something else. Like, you have to prioritize. Not everything deserves the level of careful documentation based on its value of, like, essentially, will I ever have to refer to this? Will this ever be useful in the future? Again, if you're not doing it as just like a fun thing that you like to do and this is your hobby, but you're doing it because of like a concern that like I might need this again, maybe try to keep track for a year of how many things that you spend time carefully documenting have value in the future. Do you ever refer back to that? Do you ever think to yourself, boy, I wish I knew how X, Y, and Z did it. Oh, thank goodness. And the thing is, if that happens once, you're like, oh, that means my entire year full of doing this was worthwhile. But if you just look back at one thing, you documented 100, like, think about it. Like, so there, you can go, what I'm saying is you can go too far in the other direction too. Obviously not documenting anything and not having, keeping track of anything and having things leave your head the second you do them is not ideal, but the reverse is also not ideal, where you feel like you have to spend hours and hours documenting everything and you refer back to one out of those 100 things on a yearly basis. So somewhere in the middle is probably right. I'm not saying I'm the right amount or any of us are. I think I'm probably more on the, I should probably be documenting a little bit more than I am, but be aware that that spectrum exists and sort of be aware of your place on it and see if you can find peace with that.
Thank you to our sponsors this episode, Squarespace and Delete Me. And thanks to our members who support us directly. You can join us at ATP.fm/join. One of the many perks of membership is ATP Overtime, our weekly bonus topic. Every episode, we have an extra topic that we do in overtime just for members. You can join and you can listen to everything we've ever done in the past and all ongoing ones in the future. ATP.fm/join. This week, Overtime is about Apple's all-glass hardware dreams. There's been some fun new patent filings uncovered about an all-glass iPhone and more. We're going to talk about that in Overtime. So, ATP.fm/join if you want to hear it. Thanks so much. We'll talk to you next week.
Now the show is over. They didn't even mean to begin. Cause it was accidental. Oh, it was accidental. John didn't do any research. Marco and Casey wouldn't let him. Cause it was accidental. Oh, it was accidental. And you can find the show notes at ATP.fm. And if you're into Mastodon, you can follow them at CASEYL. ISS, so that's Casey Liss, MARCOARMENT, Marco Arment, SIRAC, USA Syracuse, it's accidental, they did.
right, so here in the U.S. and the world, we're kind of messing with the entire global economy. We, as Casey said earlier, we're sorry for what our country is doing. Forgive us as best as you can. So, you know, we're in the era right now of like these, you know, the Trump tariffs, you know, hitting the economy. And today he is delaying them for 90 days because, of course, you know, what we need is more uncertainty from this administration.
Yeah, that's the whole thing about the situation is we're recording this at like, you know, 10 p.m. on Wednesday, April 9th. By the time you listen to this, who knows? Yeah. Well, like, we can't possibly say anything that is relevant to like, oh, here's what's happening, what you should do. But just uncertainty is the key word here. We have no idea what's going to happen.
Yeah, it's chaos is the word. It's just constant chaos. And, you know, obviously there's a lot of political angles of this, but what I wanted to cover here, which was, I think, more directly relevant for our show, is how do we think the tariffs are going to affect tech products and what we might do or have done as a reaction to that? So my feeling is, again, this is going to be chaos. It's not, we don't know what is going to happen. We don't know how it's going to all end up. But what we do know is that the era of like, I'm pretty sure, you know, like it's I think it's going to be very similar to early COVID when like supply chains are thrown into chaos. Things have, you know, ripple effects. Like, you know, it might seem okay now, but then like for some reason in 6 months, you can't get a car because everything, there's some shortage or something. Like there's going to be stuff like that happens because our supply chains, as we learned during COVID, like our supply chains are very fragile. Like everything has been optimized to, you know, to the ends of the earth. And so everything is like interlinked and optimized and there's no slack anywhere in the system. And so when you have like big shocks to it or big unpredictability to it, you can have weird ripple effects that are bigger than you think they'll be or that are further in the future than you think they would be. And so what I think this affects for us and as tech fans is pricing and availability of hardware. I think that is like the number one thing that we will see that's relevant to us as nerds besides, you know, global economic changes. But like how this will hit nerds specifically, I think, is hardware pricing and availability. So I'm wondering, like, do the two of you, like, have you considered this and have you maybe made any decisions or plans as a result?
I have. This was an easy one for me. As soon as, I mean, I should have actually done this sooner, but being a procrastinator, I just waited until it was like, oh, yeah, I meant to do this. My daughter is a senior in high school. She'll be going off to college in the fall. I knew I was going to get her new laptop for college. I knew exactly which laptop it was going to be, M4 MacBook Air, as discussed on the program. That machine has already been released. She's not going off to college until September. But like, what am I waiting for to buy it? And I kept saying, I should probably just get that. I always plan to get it a little bit early because I'm going to use it on my Long Island vacation as my photo computer. But it's as these, you know, whatever the As it became more likely that the various random things our idiot president was saying about tariffs were actually going to result in some kind of action for some period of time, I said, you know what? There's no reason for me to wait. There's not going to be a better, different computer that comes out between now and September that I need to get. And by the way, because my son is also in college, I can just use his student discount, which actually isn't that great these days. Student discounts, let me tell you kids, because college discounts on Macs used to be amazing. Now they're just like, eh. Anyway, I used his college student discount to get my daughter's M4 MacBook Air. And I bought it now just because, first of all, like I knew I was going to buy like custom config, like I'm getting more RAM and blah, blah, blah. Like it's not just like a stock one, so I can't just go to an Apple store and get it. And like, what's going to happen? Availability, price, it's uncertainty is entirely up in the air. And so this wasn't even a difficult choice because sometimes it would be like for replacing my Mac, it's like, oh, what am I even going to replace it with? I don't even know. Maybe I should wait to see what machines come out. No, this was a no-brainer. M4 MacBook Air. She was getting one. I knew she was getting one before they released that machine. I'm like, 100%, you're getting an M4 MacBook Air. So I bought one. It's going to be delivered on Monday. I bought it, I ordered it like a week or so ago, and I think it is one of those custom, when you buy custom ones, don't they all ship from China these days?
I think
like
so.
They're not in stock anyway. It's custom, it's got more RAM than normal, it's silver, whatever. That is arriving. That is the only thing I've done so far because this year is not my phone year. I've got a 16 Pro and I buy a phone every other year, so I'm not looking to buy a phone this year, but this is my wife's phone year. And it could be that she skips this year if it turns out the phones are either not available or horrendously expensive, because she's got a 15 Pro and it's perfectly fine. And she's on a 2-year schedule as well. So there's some uncertainty about that. But the only thing I've actively done was I moved up the purchase of a computer that I was already going to buy. Not because I think necessarily anything is going to happen, but that's the whole thing. It's uncertainty. Nobody has any idea from day to day what's going to happen, which is terrible. And again, we apologize to the world. It's terrible for everybody. But that was one thing that I could do, which seems like a big thing. It's like, oh, you made this pretty expensive purchase. But again, I was going to make it anyway. But so far, that's the only thing I've done.
Yeah, I haven't done anything yet. Although it did occur to me earlier today, like a few hours ago, that I'm really glad that the fridges died when they did, because I have no idea if those came from China or if they were if there will be more brought to the States. I mean, it would have been a total mess. Now, I don't have too much to say about the tariffs. I don't properly understand. I don't think I really understand what the goals are, and I'm not sure that the government does either. It just seems like a measuring contest to me, and I'm not sure that we're winning, but that's okay, I guess.
Does anyone ever win when that's really the dynamic? Everyone's losing.
Yeah, 100%. But no, I haven't made any purchases. There's nothing that I was looking to purchase that I thought I need to accelerate. Like, I'm not looking to buy a car right now. I'm not looking for any new computer equipment. Presumably, I would be getting a phone this September, I guess, maybe, if it's not $3,000. I personally perceive it as part of my job to get a new phone every year so I can talk about it. Also, it's convenient because I really like new stuff. Mm-hmm. but I might take the John approach this year, because I think it's well within the realm of acceptability to buy a $1,500 phone on an annual basis. Because I genuinely, as much as I snark, I genuinely believe that it makes a show better by two-thirds of us getting a new phone every year. But maybe I would say no this year. If it's really, 2x the cost, then I don't know what I would do. And we'll cross that bridge when we get there.
I mean, you could end up getting, for example, the non-pro phone, if that saves any money. Like, we have no idea what's going to happen. But it is something that we're thinking about. And, like, I think we've seen a lot of questions about this, like ATP-related questions, like, hey, what should I do about purchasing and stuff? And the few times I've responded to people about this, I've basically said, like, there's no, like, we can't give any advice. Like, there's no plan or thing that you should do other than, like, this type of thing that I did, which is, like, you were going to do this anyway, just move it up. Like, if it's not, if you have the money now and you were going to get this, you know exactly what computer you were going to get. Like, that's the only thing that's actionable. Everything else is 100% speculative, because honestly, we can't give any advice. Like, oh, if you care about something, you should buy it now. Because what? Because you know what's going to happen this whole year? We don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. Like, oh, Casey, you should definitely get a new fridge if your fridge is old, because you're not going to be able to get fridges. We don't know that. We have no idea what's going to, like, it's just, it is like COVID, the beginning of COVID. It was like, nobody has any idea what the next day will bring. So there actually is not, unfortunately, there's not any obvious advice. Like, it's not even obvious advice to say you should buy things that you think are going to be expensive later, because, like, maybe that's just causing you to make a purchase that you wouldn't have made otherwise, right? And especially with tech products, like, half of the things we talk about in the show is like, is this the time to buy product X, right? I'm going to say, this is not the time to buy an M3 Ultra Mac Studio for the same reason as we discussed on the show, unless you really, really know you need it. It's and nothing about the uncertainty of the future changes that. Like, so don't be careful about, like, I don't know, like, panicking or like doing something that you would otherwise not do because you think you know what the future will hold. Nobody knows. And it could cause you to, like, because if it turns out, like, oh, I was worried about which tech product I'm going to get, but it turns out I can't get potable water anymore. Suddenly, the fact that you pre-purchased an M3 Ultra Mac Studio doesn't look like such a wise decision. Like, we don't know what the next thing is going to be. Oh, remember when the bees invaded? And like, oh, we don't have enough bees to invade. I should pick another analogy. Sorry. Climate change. Anyway, like, this is the problem with the situation. There actually isn't much actionable advice that you can give. And if you see anyone saying with certainty that you should do X, Y, and Z that you weren't going to do before because they know that what the future will hold, they don't. Nobody knows. It's terrible.
Well, I chose to buy a laptop. I mean, that's
what did you buy?
That's Marco's solution to everything.
Yeah, it's
I mean, yeah, right.
I think I have a head cold. I might buy a laptop.
Yeah. New underwear might be laptop time.
No, so basically, yeah, I went to my family on this past weekend, like on Friday, you know, as it was becoming apparent this past weekend that like, oh, stuff's gonna go bad on Monday probably. Like things were going that direction. So I went to the family and I'm like, hey, is there any technology that we think needs to be replaced this year? You know, like, let's look at it and see what we can maybe buy right now. Like, how's your old iPad doing? Like, how's the battery lasting on that? You know, stuff like that. Like, look around. Like, do you need a new iPad or laptop anytime soon? Like, this is probably going to be, like, this could be a dicey situation for pricing, availability, or both. So, like, hey, what do we need? And for the most part, everything, you know, you start looking around, like, well, this looks fine. Like, you know, this iPad, you know, this ancient iPad, like, the battery doesn't last very long, but we don't use it that much, so it's probably fine. You know, so for the most part, everything was, like, pretty good. The one thing I decided to, you know, send my M2 MacBook Air down the line of hand-me-downs to a different role and try out the M4 MacBook Pro with the anti-glare, the what do they call it, nanotexture screen, which will solve some of my train and ferry usage problems in the sunlight. And that's it. So I got like a pretty low-spec M4 MacBook Pro, the 14-inch one, and the regular M4 series, not the M4 Pro and Max one.
It'll be interesting for you to report on that, because I'm not entirely sure nanotexture will actually help you with your sun situation. I guess it depends on whether what you are being distracted by reflections versus having sun fall on the screen at an oblique angle, in which case the nanotexture may make that worse by raising all the black levels. But anyway, you'll report back and let us know how it goes.
Yeah, and I mean, the reality is it'll probably be an improvement in both ways, because in addition, you know, compare to the MacBook Air screen, in addition to it having nanotexture as an option, it's also way brighter at the max setting.
Yeah, that is probably going to make the biggest difference.
Yeah. So like you know, right now, like when I'm using my MacBook Air on the train or on the ferry, it's almost always at max brightness. And even then, it's like I'm kind of squinting sometimes, like, oh, I really need a little more, you know, for comfortable usage here. That's why I think, like, let me give it a try. And so
you should try those utilities that let you, like, turn, like, go above. I think the limit is, like, 700 nits now, but you can bring the whole screen up to 1600. I think you'll be able to see that pretty well, but it'll kill your battery.
Yeah, well, it'll be really hot. Battery will last, like, you know, 2 hours at most.
Small price to pay.
But, yeah, and I think, you know, as John was saying, like, I think, you know, for listeners, I think that is probably, you know, the right move is, like, look at what you're going to need for, like, the rest of the year, and anything where, like, the price isn't really going to change, or it's not about to be updated in some major way that you care about, consider maybe buying that like right now.
Yeah, like you already knew what you were going to get.
Yeah, exactly. Like if you're like, like John, your situation was a perfect example. Like I'm going to buy a MacBook Air this summer. Maybe buy it now. You know, like that kind of thing. Where I'm like, this laptop, I'm probably going to replace this laptop in the next few months. You know what? The M5 version is coming out in the fall, maybe, but like the M4 to M5 probably isn't it isn't rumored to be that big of a deal. Whereas the M6 one is rumored to be a big deal, but that's a couple years off probably still. So like, you know, like, okay, I'll get the M4 one now, see how it goes, and, you know, figure that out later.
The only caveat I'll add on this is that if you are moving a purchase up on the calendar to like do it sooner than you expected to, and you don't already have the money saved up for it.
Well, yeah.
Think twice, because that again gets back to my thing of like, well, what if 2 months from now I don't have potable water? Right, like conservation of resources. Like, yes, if you you may say this is a no-brainer, I was going to get this laptop anyway, but actually I have two more months where I'm saving money for it, and I don't actually have the money now at all, but I can dip into savings a little bit to get this sooner. Are you going to regret that if you need that savings later in the water wars? Just like think, that's what I'm saying about the uncertainty. Like, it's a no-brainer for me because I already have the money set aside for it. It's like, you know, it didn't, there was literally no impact, but if there's any impact, think twice about it, because even though that's like, quote unquote, a sensible thing to do from a tech purchase perspective, are tech purchases going to be the most important thing to you in X number of months or years? There's so much uncertainty about just the basic functioning of society that it's hard to know, like it's hard to recommend people to move up tech purchases unless they're sure that they have the means to cover that and it's not impacting like their monthly budget in an adverse way, and they're like, oh, we'll make up for it later. Will you? What about when your government contracts that used to fund the company you work for go away and you don't have a job anymore?
Yeah, but and you know, even in an optimistic scenario where a lot of this stuff gets never minded away, as so many of these terrible government things do, even then we're still going to have chaos. We're still going to have, you know, unpredictability. We're going to have fluctuations. You already, because of people doing what John and I did, there's already like runs on certain products. Like, you know, we're getting reports like Apple stores are really crowded. Everyone's like, you know, rushing in to buy whatever they need like right now because they know that, you know, it might not be available in a few months or whatever. Like, and I think one thing to consider too is like Apple is actually pretty well positioned to play the tricks required to not be hit too hard by this. Now, one thing's for sure. Apple will not give up margin. They will not just make less money. We know that. Like, that option is off the table. There is no way Apple's going to just suck up tariffs and just make less money. But they have the resources to play a lot of tricks to optimize the system, not only through just, you know, direct butt kissing and you know, bribing our dictator, which they are happy to do and are doing, but also, you know, they can do tricks like, well, we're going to take these parts that were made in China, we're going to first send them like to India and then send them to, you know, they can do tricks like that, like kind of arbitrage the system and, you know, work different angles so that they don't quite pay the full tariffs. But rest assured, like, if Apple's costs go up to Apple, they will absolutely pass it on to us. There is no way Apple is just going to sit back and accept lower margins. So if that system does hit Apple, we will definitely see higher prices. But Apple has the resources to dodge and weave and play politics in this area. I think this is more likely to have a bigger hit on other companies, especially smaller companies. So, you know, if there's something made from foreign parts, which is many things for many good reasons, but if something is made from foreign parts that you are looking to get maybe in the near future, that especially from like a smaller company or a less, you know, high profile company than like a big tech giant.
It doesn't have to be a small company. It's low margin products. Like, televisions are notoriously low margin products these days. Huge companies make TVs, but the margin on TV sets, unless you're buying one of the very highest end of one of a few brands, the margins are so low, which is why they've bombarded with ads. That low margin product is going to be impacted way more than a high margin product that potentially manufacturers could absorb some amount. And by the way, on that topic, I saw at least one person, I saw Benedict Evans doing the math, saying that, again, this was days ago, so who knows what numbers they were using, but that Apple literally can't absorb the tariffs on the iPhone. They would lose money on each one they sold if they tried to absorb them, because he did the math on like price of parts and blah, blah, blah. And I don't know how accurate his math was, because nobody really knows what the real number is here, but it's within the realm of possibility, especially given the ever-increasing tariffs on China, that Apple could not absorb, even if they wanted to, which they don't, they could not absorb them, because they would be losing hundreds of dollars in every phone sold, and that's not good business.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, like, if they can do some trick where it's like, well, we worked the system such that our, you know, 38% hardware margin is now going to be like 30%. No, they won't accept that. They will, believe me, they will raise prices. Like, there's no way Apple will make less money. Like, I guarantee you that. Rest assured, like, if these tariffs end up happening and affecting Apple, we will pay higher prices, no question. And of course, I mean, we're going to have massive inflation no matter what. But anyway, you know, look at smaller things that you're looking at. Like, if you want to like replace, you know, like a Kindle or something, I mean, you know, or like, you know, some like, you know, boutique electronic thing that you're getting off of, you know, a smaller maker, like, maybe place that order now. If you were going to wait on it a little bit, like, maybe do that now, because the smaller the manufacturer, the more likely it is for them to have their costs go up significantly and for them not to be able to dodge and weave and play tricks to avoid them. And similarly, you know, what Casey said earlier, that matters a lot. Like, if you maybe have like an important household appliance or a car that you think needs to be replaced like in the near future, that might get harder. And so maybe do what you can to maybe, you know, explore some options for that, like, yesterday. Like, really, like, that could really hurt in the future.
Even if it was like, well, in a year we're thinking of getting a new car, it's rather than buying a new car now, maybe buying a used car now because you don't have the money for a new car. But like in 2 years, maybe used cars will be impossible to find and cost $100 billion. Like this, there's so much uncertainty about everything, not just like, oh, new fancy tech products. But like, I mean, just look at the egg situation. Like everything is connected and you have no idea what's going to be the thing that you didn't think about. That like, so it's, again, if you really super duper need a car, don't run out and buy the new car that you were still saving money for. But like, if you know, this is all just speculative. If you're worried, like I don't want to be in a situation 2 years from now where I can't get a car for the amount of money that I saved, but I can get a used car now for the amount of money I've saved, maybe think of that as an option. But it's just so hard to give concrete advice because we just all have no idea what the next day will bring.
Yeah. And if you have something that's like in pretty good shape right now, but could use some kind of maintenance or repair to extend its lifetime by a lot, like if you like a battery replacement on an older electronic device, or like, you know, replace like the junction box in your car or whatever, you know, like some kind of like, if there's something where you can repair something that works fine otherwise and extend its lifetime for months or years into the future, this is probably a really good time to do that, because like the greatest time to have a really well functioning car that you own outright is right now. Because whatever happens to that market, there's going to be ups and downs, and you won't be in that market anytime soon if you're in that kind of situation. So that's how it was, you know, during the COVID car crisis too. Like that was a really good time to own a car and not need to be shopping for one. This is probably going to bring that level of uncertainty or something like it. Start optimizing for it now and start thinking like, okay, whatever you can extend the life of it. And if you need to replace something, replace it while it's plentiful and not when everyone else needs to do it and there's nothing on the shelves.